Members, we're going to start. I'm told we are now at quorum. Members, today we're going to finish the 11, hopefully knock on wood, finish the 1179 as amended bill. I can't remember whether or not we actually, on the record, laid it over yesterday, so I'm just to cover my bases, I'm going to move that House File 1179 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to K-12 Finance Committee. Members, we have 14 amendments at the table, and I certainly would be my hope that we can get through the amendments and act on the bill before we adjourn. We're scheduled to adjourn at 10. If we can't do that, we will recess and come back at 6:30 this evening to finish our work for today. Please keep that in mind as we move through the discussions of the amendments and as we take the actions that we do here today. The first amendment that I'd like to take up is the A13 amendment, which is my amendment. And it's for the most part, members, it does minor technical corrections. There are some helpful corrections or minor wording changes that were identified on lines 1-7 through 1-12 of the amendment that came from advice from Dr. Yeh at the University of Minnesota when we asked him to review those line items. We reinsert language that we had inadvertently struck from the department's bill on line 113. We do strike language from the department on line 115. When we looked at that language, we were pretty convinced that the language was not clear about what it does, and we think it's perhaps superfluous language. There's some helpful correction technical language to Representative Newton's bill on line 116. We do remove the State Academy's provision. That's on line 117 of the amendment. We heard from the academies that on second thought that they did not want to proceed with that particular request. And then on line 118, there's a repealer that we simply just missed related to the Newton special ed mandate reduction bill. And so we're inserting that repealer that was inadvertently left out. So members, for the most part, this is really a technical amendment. Again, the big change here is the removal of the State Academy's proposal for direct temporary parental placement of students in the academies. Any questions, members? I would move the A13 amendment. If there are no questions, then all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. That's a good pace. We might just get out of here by now. One can never... Representative Abler is not here? Yes?
Not yet.
Okay. Representative Peterson here. Sandy's here. Okay. Representative Dabney, you have, I'm told, the A17 amendment, which does some language, or does some amendment to Representative Kalin's provisions in the bill. I believe there's two provisions.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I have an H11797 amendment.
I'm sorry, that is absolutely correct. Representative Dabney moves the H11797 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Ms. Larson, who took the gibberish that I left on her voicemail late yesterday and turned it into literate enough language that I didn't recognize it when I first walked in.
Representative Dabney, you are now leaving gibberish language on recorded messages?
That's not new. as Ms. Larson could testify to. Yeah. Sometimes I'm not leaving it on messages. Sometimes it's live. The two issues related to Representative Kalin's language on computer adaptive testing and the like that occurred to me yesterday. One is that the testing folks from the department indicated that the tests developed were developed with the intent that they could be given to students more than once each year, but the language in the bill only referred to from one school year to the next school year. And if we're able to provide the tests more frequently than that, we should be able to track the data from those tests more frequently than that. And secondly, nowhere in the discussion of making the data from the tests available were parents indicated. And this, I think, I'm hopeful that the reference to parents is merely comfort language to assure parents that the test data is released to them, not necessary, but comfort language. And I would ask for support on both aspects of the amendment.
Very well. Members, are there any questions? Representative Dabney, is there anyone that you wish from the audience to testify on your amendment?
No, Mr. Chair. I did speak generally with Representative Kalin about this, both of these issues yesterday, and he was open to this amendment. I have not had the time to show it to him, but he recognized both issues.
And Representative Dabney, I also did speak with Representative Kalin and had asked him to make sure that, because he'd been working with the department at the very least, to be able to share information with the department on this and with a couple of other members who are most interested. I am told, and it didn't come from Representative Obermuller, that on line 1.6, after the word parents, there should be a comma inserted. Would you care to incorporate that into your amendment?
Could I have a roll call? Okay, that was a joke. I'll incorporate it.
Representative Dabney incorporates an amendment after the word parents on line 1.6. All in favor of the H1179-17 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you for doing the grant.
Okay, very good. Is Peterson not going to do this? Representative Peterson, I have an A-12 amendment, which I believe is yours. We can certainly take that up now if you like, or take it up later.
Fine, thank you. I also had to go to Ms. Larson, who had to explain to me what my gibberish was in terms of the law. But what this does, it basically...
Representative Peterson, if you need time for that, we can come back to the amendment.
No, that's okay.
Okay, very well.
She helped me with it.
All right, so you wish to move the A-12 amendment?
Yes.
Representative Peterson moves the A-12 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a simple amendment that says that there will be... that the Department of Education, Commissioner of Education, will be sure that each school board does have policies around the dismissal for bullying, and this simply... puts into effect the process for informing students and parents and the public in each of those districts about what that policy will be.
Very well. Members, are there any questions? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, we already have on to anti-bullying legislation. Could you explain does this go further? Does this change something?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, we do have legislation that says you have to have a policy, but it doesn't talk about how you will portray this to the public, to the students, and to the constituents in the district. And this simply says that there will be a way of communicating to the public, usually in the student handbook. It just goes like an infant step beyond for implementation. And it's part of, and it also is important in terms of student dismissal. It's part of the student dismissal. Students have a right. If in some way, according to the policy, they're to be dismissed, then it should be in the law, or it should be in some way in writing so that parents and students know what those regulations would be.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I think we all agree on that, that needs to be, we've got the policy. We ask school boards to put in place a policy. We've told them that they have to. Again, I don't remember how I voted, and I may have voted against that, thinking that they could probably do that for themselves, but we did pass it into law. Now we're going a step further and saying, not only will you have a policy, but we're also going to tell you where you need to publish it and how you need to tell people. And quite frankly, with the almost the inference that they don't know enough that they could tell people this. And I'm not sure we need to get to that level of detail and scrutiny and quite frankly, mandating that they spend time going through and making sure, now are we covering where we're supposed to say this now? I think quite frankly, I would like to defer and I guess I'm not going to support this particular one, Representative Peterson. I think we can rely on our school boards to know that they should get this word out, and they do have policy booklets that they go through and put together each year to hand out to their students and to their parents. And I'm just concerned that we start going into the level of dictating what's in there at a detailed level. I think we're overmanaging this and getting to a level of detail. So that's my concern with it.
Representative, you care to respond, or Representative Falk has a question? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my school districts had exactly the issue you're talking about, Representative Demmer, where there was a student that was being bullied and being harassed, and nobody knew where the policy was. They had a policy, but none of the students knew, none of the teachers knew, most of the administration didn't know, the school board didn't know, nobody knew where it was, and none of the parents knew. And so by prescribing where it needs to be would have taken care of all of that trouble, might have helped this kid out a whole year or maybe even 2 years sooner than what he finally did get the help that he needed. So I think that it's a good idea to make sure that it's out there where everyone can find it.
Members, further discussion? If not, Representative Peters, if not, all in favor of the A-12 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The chair's in doubt here. If we can have a show of hands, all in favor of the A-12 amendment, please raise your hand. All opposed, same sign. On a vote of 8 in favor and 10 opposed, the amendment does not prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
I'd like to move the A-14 amendment.
Representative Benson moves H-1179-A-14.
Mr. Chairman, this amendment is very simple. It simply adds a representative of non-licensed classroom professionals so that we have the possibility of having a school psychologist or counselor or social worker, school nurse, etc., as one of the members of the board. And so that is an addition then to the other members that are already identified in the...
We have a couple questions. Members, we have not have discussed this issue to date in this committee. I became aware of this issue just yesterday, and I think it deserves some careful discussion in terms of providing some background information about what was the need for this particular approach. We do have a couple questions. Representative Greiling?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with your comments, but on the face of it, I do support this amendment since these are groups that are licensed by the Board of Teaching, if I understand it correctly. And it seems to me that there are different types of issues perhaps with these groups than a regular classroom teacher who would tend to be on this board would have knowledge of. So So I do support the amendment.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not opposed to this. I do wonder, having listened to Representative Dreiling's comments, though, if a speech pathologist can speak for a school counselor or a social worker or whatever, because they each do have different needs. And I guess I'm a little uncomfortable putting this in without any more discussion than we're going to be having today. The question I would have, perhaps for the author, is this adding a new position to this board? Will this have a fiscal cost of any sort? I don't know if they're reimbursed or mileage or anything that might impact the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I suspect it may, if there is compensation for the other board members.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Representative Benson. Have you talked to somebody from the Board of Teaching about this, if they approve of this?
No, I'm sorry. I was just asked to offer this amendment about 5 minutes ago. It's from a very reputable group called Education Minnesota. I would say, I did teach reading for a number of years in my other career, and I can see some advantage of having input from a non-professional such as a school counselor. Sometimes there are family and other issues that impinge on a child's ability to acquire learning skills. And so it's just another individual to kind of flesh out maybe the discussion of reading issues and problems for kids. That's
members, why don't we see if there are folks in the audience who can help us understand either the ramification or the intent behind the amendments. Anyone in the public that wishes to, and we do have some more questions, anyone in the public wishes to testify on the amendment, please come forward. Morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Shep Harris, here on behalf of the Board of Teaching, and as far as I know, Karen Ballmer, Ms. Ballmer, the executive director, hasn't seen this amendment yet, and I don't know if this messes up the process or not in terms of trying to get this in. I don't know if there's another stop where we could possibly get this in, but I would feel more comfortable if we were able to just check this with the Board of Teaching and make sure that they were comfortable. It's probably fine, but so I just want to make sure it's okay with them first, if that's a possibility.
Thank you. Ms. Salzlager?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Offlager, Education Minnesota, I was asked by our general counsel to put this together and talk to a legislator who's very interested in this issue, although it's not in this committee. And so we decided to proceed, even though we understand that there hasn't been a lot of time for the discussion. These individuals do have different types of, even though they're licensed teachers, you can tell just by this language that their working situation is much different than a regular classroom teacher. And these individuals feel that there should be some sort of representation on the Board of Teaching for them. And while a social worker might not necessarily understand all the dynamics within the work of a counselor, they were with more understanding about the differences of those types of professions as compared to the regular classroom teacher. And so they felt that they should have some sort of representation. And if this bill, certainly we would be happy if this bill, if this amendment gets in, to talk with the Board of Teaching as this bill progresses through the House and also through the other body.
Thank you, Ms. Salzlager. Representative Downey and Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe more just a comment. I think are seeing evidence here of the blurring of the lines between our educational system and our human services and medical systems, and I think this is one piece of evidence that we're probably starting to enter into a zone that I'd be very uncomfortable with. On the surface, it seems to simply allow kind of the paraprofessionals and non-teaching folks within the school community to be represented on the Board of Teaching, but I think it's also one more indicator, a little bit of a red flag for me, that our schools are being asked to serve as human services delivery vehicles, mental health vehicles, medical vehicles, and I think that's the line we should be really careful about going across. So I'd vote against this simply because of that fact. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a quick question. Social workers licensed psychologists, that sort of thing, that's the same bargaining unit, isn't that, as the teachers? I believe that's the same bargaining unit.
I believe it is.
When they negotiate.
Yes, I believe it is.
I guess, I mean, I can understand. They are a different type of, they are not classroom. I understand that, and I understand there's some differences here. They are represented by six teachers, as far as the bargaining unit is concerned, who I would assume would also be looking for the and the interests of everybody that they represent. But on the other hand, I do understand that even though they're in the same bargaining unit, they have a different thing that they do in the school. I guess for me, this is something that we maybe should be taking testimony on and having a hearing on and discussing. We're talking about the change of a makeup of a board here. It seems kind of quick. And so my thinking, Mr. Chair, is that this may have merits, and I may even be inclined to support at some point in time. I'd just like to have a chance to not offer these as amendments this way and have a chance to hear it out in greater committee.
Thank you. Representative Benford.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think possibly it would be useful that we introduce this at a later time after having an opportunity to speak to the Board of Teaching, so I would withdraw this amendment.
Thank you. Representative Benson withdraws the A14 amendment. Representative Abler, I believe you have the A2 amendment.
Thank you.
Representative Abler moves the H1179A2 amendment.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a kind of a perennial issue. I think this passed off the floor the last 2 years. And this is about requiring a meeting at the local level for locally developed standards. And someone called a mandate, and I think it's more of a requirement. And mandate seems like you have to do a lot of work, and it's burdensome and cumbersome. And you have to do a lot of stuff, and so maybe it's a nuance, but it is something that they have to do. Why would you make them want to do this? If you have a standard, you should do it. That's kind of the point of it. And we're for high standards. We're for doing what you say. In the nursing home world, there was a bill that if you did Alzheimer's treatment, you had to do the treatment you said, and that was controversial, but people thought it made sense. And so that actually became law, and this is like sort of truth in advertising. For some students, when they take their, and the arts teachers have not been around this year on this, so they were around very much in the last 2 years working on this. And it, for some kids, the reason they go to school is because of art or because of the local, or because of some program that they really like. And they endure math to get to their art. And in times when they're lean, if you're not going to do art or if you're not doing these programs, then don't tell people that you're doing them. And their answer to this was not to create a whole statewide standard or some rigorous thing you have to meet, but as a district develops the standards, just as a meeting report how it's going with what you said you would do. As a meeting, it doesn't even require how long the meeting has to be, or it could be at the end of a school board meeting. But they felt, and I agree, that the attention that this would give this niche of the school standards that they've already adopted would make a big difference. Turns out, and we had in testimony last year, that some schools have very nice standards in some of these non-academic areas, but they actually do not do them. They sneak in art before school. Kids can't get there, and so some of these. Anoka has magnet schools for the arts, and they allow some of these kids to express themselves, and they stay. And as we worry about kids following all the way through, especially not the kids who, you know, a lot of us, I presume most people at the table have urged their kids to stay in school and they're not at risk of dropping out. But as families have less resources and less, put-togetherness in terms of how their life is going, and mobility and the issues of single parent families, and as those challenges come, some of these little pieces of glue are what keeps a kid going. And so that was the purpose of the bill. The House agreed last year, I think without dissent, as it left the floor. I mean, I think it left the floor before that. The Senate wasn't interested in doing this, and so I bring it again and hoping that we can give it another shot to help some of these kids maybe see their way through. And it's will answer all the world's problems? No, but it's a small piece of some of these kids to keep them on track and maybe do some achievement gap stuff and help some of these other groups get to graduation and get on to college and succeed. I think it would be. So that's my amendment, Mr. Chair, and I hope you can adopt it.
So, Mr. Representative Abler, the youthful exercise that you're asking the local school board to do, I initially understood it as it related to the art standard, but is that your intent, or is it also to report the other locally developed standards? We have social studies, health sci-ed, world languages, career and tech, as part of that universe of standards.
Well, frankly, Mr. Chair, it's written, I think, for all those, but the social studies teachers haven't come to me worried about kids loving the social studies, or with all respect to those teachers. But it seems like those academic classes do better than the non-academic ones. And so if it would be more palatable, maybe the Senate would take it if we just had it arts. I'm comfortable with actually withdrawing it and just making it arts. I hadn't thought of that, but that's who came last year, and that's who...
Right.
Were the passages for this topic. Did that help, you think?
Mr. Abler, you and I worked on this together. We did incorporate this into the omnibus bill, but again, as I look at the language, there's a couple of categories here. You have locally developed or statewide standards and state assessments. You have three sort of qualifying, describing, and I think that takes you beyond... My read is that would take you beyond the arts.
Well, Mr. Chair, why don't I just withdraw it, and we'll get a crack at this arts, and I'll work with
very well. Senator Abler withdraws the A2 amendment. We have an A16 amendment. I don't know who the author is. So is anyone going to offer the A16 amendment? Representative Downey. Representative Downey moves the H1179A. 16 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe first, just so people can orient themselves to what this is actually doing, all of the affected language is on page 31 of the DE2. Delete all that we're considering. And on line 29, we are effectively reversing the changes that are currently in the DE2. Removing the new language and reinstating the stricken language. And then in the clause down on clause B on line 31.32, starting on line 32, we would reinstate the stricken language and insert an and between the new clause and the previously stricken language. So we're basically combining those two provisions. And the gist of this amendment is to kind of based on the OLA's recommendations and its evaluation of QComp. I think from my perspective, from a best practices of employee reviews and reward systems, and also from a common sense standpoint, trying to retain while we add language that is perhaps more subjective or reflective to maintain the more objective components of teacher evaluations in QComp. And Representative Cass introduced the bill, and I don't know how I missed this actually when the bill was up before the committee. My assumption was that most of the language was related to licensure, and I support Representative Cass' bill to that extent. To the extent, however, that it actually eliminated the more objective components, I had submitted to him some recommended language that I'd be much more comfortable with. So I think what we're trying to do here, and I was hopeful that this might even be perceived as a friendly amendment, I'm not sure that it is from talking to Representative Gaff briefly, but to not simply replace the objective teacher evaluation components in QComp with more subjective, but to have a blend of the two. And I think that would be a good thing for teachers and the school districts and the evaluation system writ large. I don't know if anybody from the OLA, if David Kirchner is here, if anybody wants to come down and actually testify to this. If they do, I'd welcome them to come down. Otherwise, I would just point out one more comment, and that is that I think the objective components related to QCOMP have been well received by teachers and by districts. And in fact, the if you look at the reference in line 31 to staff development plans in section 122A.60 of statute, that section of statute says that the plan must include staff development outcomes, the means to achieve the outcomes. And so I think this concept of outcomes and objective assessment of an external objective assessment is frankly important and critical to the teachers being observed and evaluated as well as to the district. So I'll defer to the testifiers on behalf of this amendment with that introduction.
Mr. Senator Downey, you attracted a venerable crowd at the testifiers table. Congratulations. Good morning.
Hi, David Kirchner from the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm not really speaking either in favor of or against this amendment, but just to reflect what our recommendations were in our report. We did not really make any recommendations about the evaluation process within QCOMP one way or the other. We did not have serious misgivings about the current state of affairs, so in that sense you could read that as to some extent, you know, not anything too negative about the status quo, but we also did not look very, very carefully at exactly this particular component. The one thing that I would mention is that we did express considerable concern about different programs being held to different standards based upon when they joined the program, and to the extent that these changes might affect programs going forward but not programs that have already joined the program, I think that would be counter to our recommendations. But I suspect that can be worked out if members agree that that would be preferable. But other than that, I don't have anything further to say about this amendment one way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Kirchner. Commissioner?
Thank you. And we are appreciative of the auditor clarifying the statement so that we are clear about consistency.
And I'm sorry, Commissioner, you've done this before. You're going to need to state your name for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Commissioner Alice Egan, representing the Department of Education. And we are also here to raise concerns about eliminating the objective evaluation criteria. Recently, both the Secretary of Education and the President spoke about alternative compensation programs for teachers and actually referenced the TAPS program by which QCOMP is modeled. And that program has within it the components that we have in QCOMP, including an objective evaluation type of system. It is very important that as you're doing professional development, that you're also analyzing the implementation of those practices, those best practices that you are looking at, that you're going to be implementing in the classroom, and evaluating if they are actually having a positive academic impact upon the students. And so there are a couple of components to this objective evaluation process. We talked with Representative Kalin about certainly the language that he proposed would be a nice addition to the objective evaluation criteria, but not, should not be a substitute for it. The example I would ask you to consider is if Alice Segrin as a teacher was really good in her third grade class in instructing in reading, but was not very strong in the instruction of mathematics, and maybe particularly in a certain area. And as part of the professional development growth plan that Alice would have would be to implement some additional instructional practices to and be practicing that in her classroom. That should be not only observed but also evaluated to see if she is able to instruct in mathematics in a way that is successful. Without that, you just have merely a checklist of observation of, yes, she's practicing, but no real evaluation of whether she's meeting a professional goal. So that's why we're talking about not only professional development, because I could be professionally developing, but really not being very effective at what I'm doing. So in isolation, we can professionally develop people all day long, but we also want to have that connection of how it is impacting and how we are demonstrating our skill. That's part of the professional growth, the professionalism of teaching that is very important. And in addition to that, we also say that to be fair to the teacher, you have an objective evaluation process and rubric, and then you also are evaluated by multiple times and by potentially a team of evaluators that are trained in that. So not only would you perhaps have your principal looking at your work in your classroom, but you also perhaps will have an instructional coach and another mentor that would also be coming in, so that you have multiple people having that opportunity to observe, so that you're not dependent on one person doing that evaluation. So that's why we talk about the importance of an objective evaluation with multiple measures, with pre and post types of observation. And it's part of the total package of professional development. We appreciated Representative Salem's language about looking at reflection and that language, but we suggested keeping the objective evaluation and then adding some language that would clarify and expand on that. And I would like Pat King, who actually works directly all the time with our QCOMP program, to also comment on some of the experiences and opportunities and good things that have happened with this.
Ms. King.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's interesting that this has come up today and it's been talked about recently. We're in the middle of pursuing our peer reviews for QCOMP, and those peer reviews consist of going out to schools and districts around the state that are implementing the program. And the one thing that we hear over and over again from all the way from International Falls, St. Francis, Grand Meadow, Proctor, the center, is this is the part of the program that teachers enjoy the most. And this comes directly from the conversations with teachers. I will tell you that they are very concerned many times when the program is being put together. But after the program gets going about midway through the year, many of them recognize this is the first time they've had an opportunity to talk to one another in collegial conversations that are ongoing about student learning and student work and teacher practice in the classroom. I would also like to mention that by removing the teacher evaluation component, it adds evidence, although it removes the teacher evaluation component, it adds evidence of effective practice based on reflection and growth. The change in terms is vague, and it may not define levels for professional growth because we don't know what the standard is or what the standard should be under evidence effective practice based on reflection and growth. Some other concerns that the department would have with this change is that it could weaken the language by shifting the observation practice away from an objective evaluation program to evidence of effective practice. Again, the lack of standards or something that would clearly indicate what that looks like. Oftentimes when we work with districts and putting their program together, they'll come to us with a teacher evaluation component, and we have them describe to us what that looks like. For me as a teacher, how would I know whether or not I was getting better at what I'm doing? We have to be able to help teachers clearly understand and see what all of this would look like. We're concerned that it would eliminate the rigor of the QCOMP program and promote no change in the current practices. Without having a clear standard and understanding of what this reflective practice would look like, it could be left up to the district to interpret. It would be very difficult for many districts to really understand why some districts are doing one thing and some districts are doing another, which then sort of makes that confusion even greater.
King, I'm going to ask you to move it along if you would.
Okay. One more thing. It would also, the last thing I want to wrap up with is that it would really be difficult to link performance pay and salary reform to the new language based on this lack of standards. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I said Representative Kalin and Representative Taft. I apologize for that. Just in conclusion, I would really encourage members to support the Downey Amendment. I think it's very important that we retain the current language. We certainly look forward to working with Representative Taft in looking at some language that may reflect on some of the things that should be in an objective evaluation criteria, but to eliminate that at this point, I think would be going backwards, and I think would actually not be reflective of what even our national leaders are saying that we should be doing.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Kass.
Yeah, I guess I would definitely oppose this amendment on a few different backgrounds. First of all, an evaluation that should be objective is already a part of the process as defined, and I left that in under 31.30 there. So the objective evaluation is still there. Also under best practice, Dr. Sato came in and really did speak to the fact that reflective practice, evidence gathering, professional learning communities do have rubrics for them. There are benchmarks that are set forward by the local districts, as well as through research-based curriculum design, through curriculum mapping, through professional learning communities, about what objective outcomes must come from that to be able to support what I wrote here, which is best teaching practices, student learning, collaborative work, and continual professional learning by the instructor. So those things are there. There are rubrics and objective evaluations that go along with those that schools are using. What this does is it widens the scope of evidence gathering and the ability for a school district to use multiple measures for how that teacher is, not by saying that an individual TOSA, a teacher that is on special assignment, must leave their classroom if they're an effective teacher to go in and talk to another instructor. In my school district, we do have TOSAs, people that are out there trying to help teachers become better teachers. Not one of them is a social studies instructor. And so for, you know, people to say that those people are best trained to come into my classroom and tell me how I'm teaching, I don't see that. Whereas my professional learning community, where we do have social studies teachers, science teachers, family and consumer science teachers, we can sit down and we can talk about things because we are looking at reflective practice as well as how it is that we are implementing standards within our classrooms. So I would say that I think that this opens up the scope for even a greater opportunity for evidence gathering. Now, that's exactly what my intention was here, is to keep objective practice in place there. Many school districts also cannot be a part of QCOMP because part of their problem is that they don't have the teachers to be able to be trained to be pulled out of that classroom. TOSAs are very expensive, teachers on special assignment. And so a lot of these smaller school districts cannot do that, cannot be a part of QCOMP because they cannot then have those teachers who are trained and pulled out of the classroom. And that is a problem that's there, and it was under the Senate they spoke to this. It was during their hearing as they were talking about QCOMP and the legislative auditor's report. So some definite problems there, and I would like to see that there is some local control then in the objective rubrics that they use in using QCOMP to the best of their ability.
Thank you. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kass, I'm just offering maybe a friendly approach to this to maybe make it amenable to more people. On line 1.3 of the amendment, if we were to reinstate the stricken language and insert the word and after program, that way both would still be part of the assessment or the evaluation.
Representative Kass.
I'm amenable to the and on, are you saying on line 31.29?
Yeah.
So an objective evaluation program and evidence of effective practice that includes?
Yes.
And then keep my current language?
Representative McFarland.
Are you working off of the DE2 amendment, or the DE2, or are you working off the A16?
The A16.
I would say that I do not want to keep the current language of objective evaluations using multiple criteria conducted by locally selected and periodically trained evaluation teams that understands teaching and learning. I think it is too narrow of a focus, and that my language actually broadens the focus.
Could we hear from the commissioner in response to that?
Representative McFarland, we've heard pretty lengthy testimony from the commissioner, but certainly entertained. And Commissioner, you've been in this seat. We're trying to move this so along.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I appreciate, and we would certainly support the amendments by Representative McFarland. And I also would respond to Representative Kass. In nowhere do we define TOSAs or say that districts have to use TOSAs. Really, we encourage a multiple team evaluation type of process, and we do encourage the teachers that are doing evaluation are also still remaining in the classroom for part of the time. So I think that maybe there's some misunderstanding. There may be some school districts that use POSAs, but they also are required to use other team members for evaluation also. So it's not, I don't want members to think that that's part of this process or that we encourage that. We do encourage teachers being in the classroom as much as possible so that they have that relevant experience. However, if a TOSA is something that a school district would also like to use as part of a team, we feel that that is all right too. And I would certainly, we have urged Representative Taft to keep the stricken language and then incorporate some of his as a compromise, and we think that that would be a good thing to do.
I guess I would say that one thing that I would be willing to do is instead of saying the and on line 1.7, just to change that to an or. This would be on the A16.
The A16 amendment. Yeah. Representative Fowler?
I don't think that would work, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative,
just in the interest of moving this along, I think Representative Farland had an amendment she was suggesting on line 1.3, and maybe if we, I think that was best agreeable to the Representative Cass, and I think if you have two votes, I think that we can get done here. If we vote on 1.3 first, as it's amended, are you going to move an oral amendment on 1.3 and suggest we vote on that separately? To reinstate the stricken language and consider an and.
Representative Abler,
which up on Cass said he was favorable.
Representative Abler, you're looking for some indication whether to divide the amendment.
Right. If we just vote on line 1.3 first, I think that's an area of agreement, and I think that area will be discussed as this bill moves along.
So, Representative Abler, you're not moving division now. You're looking for some feedback, and then.
Well, I can move it. And just, I think it
would
be agreeable.
Trying to be helpful here, and I want to set that in that spirit. So, before we move to the division, let me hear from the author of the provision, and then we'll hear from the author of the amendment. Representative Cass?
Line 31.29, as it would be then under line 1.3, would be an objective evaluation program and evidence of effective practice that includes. I would be amenable to that change.
Okay. Can I move that then, just to get us moving to a different point here? I'll move that we that I would amend line 1.3 to just reinstate the stricken language and insert an and after program. And then we're not going to delete the new language on that. And I would like to vote on that first.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dolly.
I just want to be clear. So all we are voting on at this point is the insertion of and into the original DE2 amendment on line 31.29, and we are not voting on dividing the amendment or anything related to the remaining provisions of my amendment.
I think that's correct.
I'd like to vote on line 1.3 first. I think that's an area we agree on. I think another part.
I would receive that as a friendly amendment.
I'm hearing two different things, though. I'm hearing an amendment to the amendment on the one hand, and I'm also hearing
a movement to divide.
A movement to divide.
After he incorporates, if he incorporates that as a friendly amendment, then now I move to divide it and vote on line 1.3.
Two separate votes, I think. Not sure.
You can incorporate
the parliamentary. I would not receive division as a friendly.
No, that's not my point.
So that's why I'm asking.
No, but he can incorporate. If you don't mind incorporating that text,
and then we can leave the amendment and with that insertion.
But then I can move to divide it if I want.
Yes, correct. I support the First Amendment.
So
very well.
Am I helping or not?
Representative Cass, I think we're hearing, at least at this stage, we haven't voted on the amendment, at this stage of the discussion, to insert the word and on line 3.1.29, the trick here is how to do that and reinstate the stricken language. So Representative Downey will incorporate. Not quite sure technically how we're going to do this. Perhaps some folks can help us on line 1.3 to reflect those two actions, essentially.
Correct.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the document H1179A16, page 1, line 3, what you would be doing is removing, delete the new language and, so that all would remain is reinstate the stricken, the word language is missing, and after program, insert and. So page 1, line 3 would read, page 31, line 29 of the H1179DE2 document, reinstate the stricken language, and after program, insert and, on page 31, line 29.
Representative Downing?
Support sense as a friendly amendment.
Very well.
Mr. Chairman, we'll divide the amendment and vote on the 91.9. No, you can correct me.
Representative Downing incorporates that language in his H15 amendment.
Representative Abler. And vote on 91.3 correct.
Representative Abler moves to divide the H16 amendment at line 1.3.
Yes.
And request for action on the 1.3 language. Representative Downing.
I'll support division.
Representative Cass.
I'll support the division of it.
Very well. So members, we're voting on the line 1.3, on line 1.3 of the 816 amendment. Are we clear? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Downey.
Move the second.
So I would move the second half of the amendment lines 1.4 through 1.8.
Representative Downing now moves the second part of the amendment, 1.4 through 1.8. Representative Cass?
I oppose that new language.
Representative Downing.
Mr. Chair, one might be slightly technical point. I still, of course, support lines 32 through 30, or I'm sorry, the lines 1.4 through 1.8 of the amendment. And I would point out that the Abler amendment to my amendment, which inserted the word and on line 31.29, in effect renders current section B in the DE2 amendment problematic if we don't insert the word and there. The heading would say an objective evaluation program and evidence of effective practice, and yet the provision underneath it in provision B would have no objective evaluation at all, so we'd have a mismatch between the heading and the content of that paragraph. So in some ways the portion of the divided amendment that we just approved creates problems with the language, and that actually was part of my handwritten comments to Representative Cass after the presentation of the bill to committee, that many of the heading changes that were being made in his bill were actually then not reflective of the content within the sub paragraphs, the content of that. So on top of arguing for the content of maintaining an objective evaluation, I think we'd have a problematic inconsistency between the heading and the content if we struck the objective component.
And Mr. Chair, I would object that under line 31.30, an individual teacher evaluation that is aligned under those standards would be objective. And we would hope that all evaluations of any sort of language under this would be objective.
Members, are we ready to vote? All in favor of the second part of the A16 amendment, lines 1.4 through 1.8, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Where are we now? H15 amendment. Representative Demmer moves the H1179A15 amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is what I spoke to you about very briefly yesterday on the floor, but I have concerns with the changing of our, and I think this is very, very key to this bill, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of time invested in deciding how we should do these assessments, and quite frankly, on the part of all of us, lots of angst. And I'm not just talking about this year, and I'm not just talking about the work group that was assembled this last summer that we worked on, and even during this session, but I'm talking about the last 5 or 6 years
that we've been looking at standards, standards to help improve achievements in our schools, and quite frankly, aligning ourselves to be world competing as well as nation leading in our education system. And part and parcel to that, Mr. Chair and members, was a goal at some point in time in the last 6 years we've been working on this to get to where we're going to have an examination, an assessment, if you will, of kids' knowledge. And at that point in time, they would pass this examination, they'd pass this assessment in order to receive a diploma. Mr. Chair, here we are in the first, on the cusp of the first year that we do this after 6 years of planning and working. And Mr. Chair, we're pulling the plug. I just don't know. We've never had a situation where the kids have been assessed under what we call motivated conditions, where the test means something. Up until this time, if you will, I would submit that a lot of the testing, a lot of the MCA2s, even the basic skills tests, have been practiced in terms of the kids' mind, in terms of whether it's important or not. Well, we need to take this big test, but does it count for anything? Not really. Now, it accounted for whether schools were making adequate yearly progress, and it accounted for those sorts of things. But I think in terms of the kids' personal motivation to do this test under non-motivated conditions, I don't think we really found how well they're prepared. And quite frankly, I have confidence, and I know some of the statistics have shown the MCA2s in the spring of 2008, I think we showed 34% were proficient. That was not the grad. Again, that was the MCA2s. I just really believe that under motivated conditions, we'll see higher levels of performance. Quite frankly, I think we'll see a higher level of scrutiny on the part of the teachers and the administrators in terms of making sure the kids understand that this is important, that this is going to mean something when you take this test. You need to pass this. I don't know too many kids that flunked their driver's test because they're very motivated. And I don't want to put this on my... Representative Norton, I stand corrected.
That was four hands.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of personal information. I also think that I now have a lifetime certificate to teach driver education.
Are you looking for business?
I choose not to do it, however.
Mr. Chairman, to this point, I passed mine, but the valedictorian in my high school class flunked hers twice.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
you may want to back out of that, Alan.
Actually, this is going to serve to prove my point, because each of the people we're talking about here did eventually pass that test, Mr. Chair.
Well, we
and
hope
that's
so.
Representative Norton, I believe, passed her test. You do drive. I'm assuming you're driving legally. Representative Dabney, I'm sure your valedictorian passed.
Eventually.
And I believe that kids taking this grad will also. We have multiple opportunities. Again, keep in mind, this is in the 11th grade taking this. After preparation for all these years, they do have multiple opportunities for remediation and retesting. And I believe under motivated conditions, just as the discussion about the driver's test, people eventually get that done because they're motivated, they want to have it, they'll take it as many times as they have to, they will study and do what they have to do. I believe that under motivated conditions, not backing away from this, we'll find those same things. And I'm very concerned, Mr. Chair, about the work that we've done. And I understand the angst that we've all have. We've worked on these sorts of things. I think there's some other issues, too. In my understanding, and I got some information, the stimulus bill, if you will, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, there are requirements in there for the funding that we may or may not get, or that we may get, that we have assessments that measure students' college and career readiness. Will this, to say that they don't have to pass this test, to back away from this, and to say we're going to study it for five more years, which I think is in the bill, is that going to be meeting that standard, to meet that scrutiny? I think we didn't discuss that, and I guess I wasn't aware of that, but it's some information I received. I'm just concerned that backing away is not the right thing for us to be doing. I think we need to trust our system, we need to trust our educators, and we need to trust that the kids can show that they have this knowledge and can do this. And I thought long and hard about this. We've had a lot of discussion about it, and I really think it's the right thing to do, to stay the course and do what we've been doing, Mr. Chair.
Representative Demmer, I would oppose your amendment. However, I would, two things. One is that the language reference here that we passed out earlier in a bill to the K-12 Finance Committee is really meant to be the first part of a what hopefully will be a comprehensive and long-term solution alternative approach, where I think there's much more meeting of the mind than there is separation. I think frankly, members, what we're trying to do is dance a very careful dance to make sure that we're able to move all the pieces together to a point where we can continue to negotiate out what that bigger comprehensive solution could be. And so I really think that these provisions need to continue to remain on the table for those discussions. I also want to point out that NCLB requirements do not require us to have a diploma denying high stakes test. They require us to have assessments that align with our standards, and in fact there are several states that do not have those high stakes components, but are nonetheless in line with federal expectations. I nonetheless accept not accepting your amendment, but I accept the spirit of your amendment, in terms of reflecting the fact that we are struggling, I think, with making sure that we're very careful that we, if we move anything forward, we're not missing key component pieces here. There's going to have to be, members, a certain level of trust that's going to have to continue to move forward in this legislative session, and I will take a second just to quickly editorialize that trust is not furthered, and Representative Demmer, you're not doing this, but that element of trust is not furthered by different sectors pointing fingers at each other in terms of accusing one another of lowering standards in our state. I've said that before, that there's no one in this body and there's no one in the executive branch that desires that particular outcome. And so I think it's important for us to keep cool heads on this issue. And so I do accept the amendment in the spirit of wanting to be a very careful representative of Denver, but nonetheless, I oppose adoption of your amendment at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do understand the spirit you're coming with, but I'll be very brief. I think it's time to move on. We may be lowering standards. I do honestly believe we're lowering some expectations here. I think we are, but I mean that's debatable. And quite frankly, I think moving forward with more discussion, this is one of those issues that, as long as there's time, and as long as we keep making time, there will be continued discussion. There is no definitive answer to this. I believe we need to be moving forward. We have kids going through our system that need to understand expectations. We have teachers, administrators, our school system needs to understand expectations. I think we have responsibility to continue to move forward. The long-term solution, I think, as we look at end-of-course exams, I'm excited about that. I think it makes lots of sense. It's being done. We need to continue moving down that path. I know we'll do that in doing this alternative pathway, too, but I do think it's important. And I guess, quite frankly, with that, Mr. Chair, I'd also ask for a roll call and a speaker vote.
Representative Demmer requests a roll call vote. Members, we ready to vote?
Yep.
Very well. The clerk will take the roll.
Mariani?
No.
Cass?
No.
Abler?
No.
Benson?
No.
Reiner?
No.
Dabney?
No.
Demmer?
Yes.
Dietrich?
No.
Stepke?
I'll pass for a minute.
Downey?
Yes.
Post?
No.
Riley?
No.
Moon? McFarland?
Yes.
Murdoch?
Yes.
Newton?
Not
here. Norna?
Yes.
Norton?
No.
Obermueller?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Flowers?
Not here.
Yes. Williams?
Not
maybe tomorrow.
Members, on a vote of 7 aye and 12 opposed, the amendment does not prevail. I've been asked by Representative McFarland to pull up the A8 amendment. I think he's had a bit of a conflict later on, and it looks like we may very well be meeting later this evening, so we'll accommodate your schedule. And you're moving the A8 amendment, Representative McFarland?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McFarland moves the A8 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had unfortunately set my town hall meeting for tonight and not knowing about this, so I apologize for this. I am, the A8 amendment is removing the language that is was in originally House File 1621, Representative Dabney's. I support what the bill is, what the language is trying to do, because we do want to have safe schools for all of our students and our staff. But I think that we're here about making good policy as policymakers, and I think that we want to make sure that it's truly vetted by all the organizations. And I'm just not really satisfied. I did do a lot of research over the weekend after the testimony last Friday, and when I'm understanding that MASE is neutral, that sends to me a red flag, because I think our special educators association should be fully supportive, or at least more supportive than neutral, when they come to us to have this passed into law. And I'm not suggesting that we just table this forever or take it off forever. I think it just needs, the groups need to reconvene, other than just doing email amendments, which I was kind of surprised today, because I was under the impression that some amendments have been made, and unless there's one today, I'm not sure, but I'm concerned about the unintended consequences to the regular ed setting, that if this bill passes, there would no longer be use of regulated procedures as part of planned interventions, and that we're moving to an educational model, from an educational model to a medical model, and how we treat the most challenging behaviors in our schools. And I'm concerned about how the use of seclusion is not being used in a therapeutic manner. And I also had specifically some concerns about on line 75.22, and we're talking about training of staff. I think there's going to be a cost to districts to be training. I think we need to look at that. And also under line 75.26, it talks about positive behavioral interventions, and I believe there's a program by that name in the state of Minnesota that's in about 100 districts. And the way this is presented might make some districts feel that they need to add this program, so that needs to be delineated maybe a little bit more, because if that's the case, we would have many school districts that would have to be adopting that program. So I just would really hope that, and also the language is extremely vague, and I think it needs to have the group reconvene and sit down together and talk about it and come together with some better language.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would oppose this amendment, but I would encourage and expect and know that they will have the group that has been working on this for years continue to do so as we move on with the legislative process. We had a bill last year that the Department of Education brought forward that had, I think, most groups gritting their teeth as well. And I think gritting their teeth and standing to bear it is about the best we can do sometimes with compromises in these emotional areas in special education. And because we haven't been able to agree, we've done nothing, and I think that's the worst thing of all. So this group has met for hours. They've been meeting since last session. They've been resorting, because of the time crunch right now, with the constant changes that people bring forward to emails, which, you know, in this day and age is a pretty good way to do things when you can't be meeting 24/7. And they have been working on the weekends with Representative Newton and others to come up with both the Dabney bill and the Newton bill. But this one, they've been working on for years. And, you know, the fact that MASE is neutral is a huge accomplishment. You know, everybody in every group has many concerns. Last year, with the bill we had, the intermediate school district, as Representative Carlin knows, said that that bill would shut them down. They would not be able to safely practice education with what was in that bill. And they testified for this bill this year. I thought it was miraculous. So I hope we will defeat the McFarland Amendment strongly, but join hands with her in asking the groups to do what they are doing, which is to continue to work on this till the bitter end, because anything can always be made better.
Thank you. It's always good to hear advice from of our now grizzled veterans.
I'm getting more grizzled all the time.
this is one issue that will grizzle you.
And grizzly, too.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and actually Chair Geiling covered much of the territory that needs covering. I too, oppose removing this language. If we want the groups to continue to work together, we need to have a forum for them to work together, and pulling the language out simply removes the forum that they need to continue down the road. If you're on a trip and you've got a timeline, you stay on the road, you don't pull over for the night and check into a motel. And that's what Representative McFarland is wanting us to do here. Hours and hours and hours of people's work have been put into this effort. Is it going to make everybody happy? No. Change is hard. I remember when I was working on the psychiatric unit doing some of the very things that are discussed here, and they came in with a new philosophy and new rules and regs that meant we were going to do a lot less restraints, and we're going to have to deal with the kids a lot more. And the restraint was the easy thing to do. Finding new positive ways to work with kids was the harder thing to do, but it was also the right thing to do. So I'd ask you to defeat the McFarland Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to Representative Greiling's comment, I would say that Representative Newton's bills have much more buy-in from all the groups than the Dabney bill.
Members, are we ready to vote? All in favor of the A8 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does not prevail. I think we have time for one more amendment, members. We are going to have to recess and come back at 6:30. We'll be in room 500 north. That will then also allow us some time for people from the citizens from the public to offer any testimony on the amended bill before we move it forward. I'm sorry, 6:30 p.m. In room 500 north. What makes sense to see here? Sure. Yeah. What number is that? The A5 amendment. This deals with the innovation revenue component.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. That is my amendment.
Representative Lewin moves the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if members will are able to find it in their stack, I'm looking for mine. And I must say, Mr. Chair, I know this amendment deletes the innovation revenue portions and your proposal. And I want to say, first of all, that I fully support, I believe, the intention of your language. What I have a problem with, and I think many of our school districts will have a problem as well, is with the mandate portion of this. The language in the DE2 amendment requires that all school districts must put 5% of their general revenue funds into this program. And as we all know, I think we're going to be struggling to try to hold schools and K-12 education harmless in the budget situation we have now. Just in this current environment, deficit environment, and the difficulty we have with our budget is going to further strap school districts' ability to have some flexibility in how they allocate their funds. And while I am fully supportive of encouraging the schools to continue their efforts on focusing on the achievement gap, I know we're going to be discussing Representative Newton's and others' proposal on integration revenue, and there's some, I think I'm very pleased with the work that group has done with regards to directing some of that revenue in that direction. I am very concerned about further mandating and restricting the use of that general fund for specific purposes. I am hearing constantly from my school district, please allow us flexibility. We know you're probably not going to be able to give us more money. Would you allow us the flexibility to do the best we can what the funds are giving us and cut some of those strings. So that is the purpose of my amendment, and I just want to indicate to the chair I appreciate the spirit and would stand in solidarity with the spirit of the amendment. I just can't go along with the mandate portion.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewin, when I first looked at this section, I was going to support your amendment as well. And because I misunderstood the section, and I think that because I thought, too, the way it's written without looking at what's on page 5, line 4, it looks like it's existing revenue. And I think that the reason it's confusing is because of some confusing directions that the Ed Finance Committee gave to the Ed Policy Committee. I asked, because this section is meant for the new Minnesota Miracle and for the innovation revenue section, which is not going to be able to be started with funding this year because we don't have funding. We got a flat target. It's my intention to propose to the Ed Finance Committee to put the new Minnesota Miracle into law to be started to be implemented in 2014 when hopefully we're out of this economic mess. Anything can be adjusted, and I'm hoping it gets adjusted to 2012 if we're out of this economic mess sooner. But because we have to balance our budget for 4 years, we cannot put it in until 2014. And then this section is what Ed Finance asked Ed Policy to work on to chip into House File 2, or, you know, when we do our omnibus bill. So I apologize for that confusion, and Representative Mariani did exactly what Ed Finance asked the Policy Committee to do. So we all need to know that we should not support this amendment to take it out, because then we wouldn't have this new language to put into the new Minnesota Miracle. So I'm not sure what we need to do to clarify, or if we look at page 5, line 4, I understand that Mr. Strom helped with that. Is that right? They're shaking their heads. Yes. So we need to just know that this section is not for current revenue. If it were, I would not vote for it either. But it's meant for the new Minnesota Miracle. So it will not be current revenue. It will not be taking money away from schools. It can only be implemented when we're adding the new money. So instead of focusing on taking it out, and all the education groups, along with myself, had to be educated on this morning, and it's my mistake and my committee's mistake. But what we should focus on with the Loon Amendment and hear from people about by the time we get to Ed Finance is the language here. We asked Education Policy to shape and clarify and flesh out the innovation revenue. We've had a lot of proposals. We had one from Representative Winkler. We had we've had a lot of discussion on how should that innovation revenue be clarified. So I would hope we would focus on how it is clarified in on pages 10 and 11 and get input before we get to finance on is that how we want the innovation revenue to be used.
Representative Faust and Representative Abler. And then we'll have to take a vote and recess. So Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe somebody can explain to me why we need line 1.3 in the amendment where we're deleting something that seems to me to be a pretty important part of funding for schools. I can understand with what you're trying to accomplish that we need page 10, line 28, delete section 3, but I don't understand why we need to delete the section 7, which is where we're basically putting the basic funding for schools in. I'm sorry, that might be a long answer to a short question, but I don't understand that.
Yeah, Representative Faust, the intent on page 5 was to make sure that the entire package is meant to be for new revenue and not a standalone provision related to the basic revenue, and I don't quite get it, but technically that's how it was advised of us to be able to structure this to make that work.
Okay. All right.
To this point, Representative Abney?
To the amendment.
All right. We have Representative Abler next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm still puzzled why. I mean, I don't know if I like the idea or not. There's no money anyway. And so you do have a, having served on finance before, the page 5 thing is definitely a finance piece. And the way the language reads in plain English, it says any basic revenue, you define the basic revenue on line 5 to include the current money they have. And the way it reads is that they have to take 5% of their current money. And so this needs to be at least amended to say if any new money that should fall from the sky, that'd be appropriate. And since it's not expected, and this still could be carried in the finance bill. And so, but the way it's written, Representative Loon's concerns are valid, and it does take 5% of the money, of existing money, for this purpose. And if you mean not to do that, then this needs to be amended. Maybe you just want to hold it over and work on it over the break. And I think that's their intent. But the words do not say what Representative Dreiling says. I'll help you with that if you want.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, I may have a solution that clarifies and arrives at Representative Loon's concerns in a different way. I'd like to amend the amendment.
Let's just do it tonight.
You know, members, we are past our time, and perhaps it might be wise to do this tonight. I think I know the direction that we're going. I think it's a good direction, and I think it might honor Representative Loon's intent here. I think your, I understand your intent has less to do with, you know, the language really on page 10, as much as, you know, make sure we're creating any unintended consequences related to our current basic revenue, regardless of what happens with Minnesota Miracle or with the Innovation Fund. So, Representative Loon, if you would be so kind as to withdraw, we'll come right back to this at 6:30 when we reconvene.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will withdraw the amendment with the intent of offering it when we reconvene.
Thank you. Representative Loon withdraws the A5 amendment. We will come back as the first order of business when we reconvene. This committee until 6:30 and or the call of the chair stands recessed. All right, members, the CSO Policy Committee will reconvene, and we're on House File 1179. We had, by my count, I think 4 or 5 amendments left, and my understanding is that we now have some true amendments. Do the best we can to make sure that we get out of here at a decent time. Obviously, it's nice to be able to have the recess. The entire recess is not to generate more amendments. But it did, and actually I have an oral one, so I'm a little bit guilty as well. Let me do my amendment, then we're going to circle over to Representative Loon. We left you in the recess unit, you were working on your amendment, and then we're going to move on to enabling amendment, and then we'll continue on. Members, on page 9, or rather, line 19, page 19, rather, line 18. This is Representative Kalin's bill, and this has to do with including the state auditor in a report certifying of the cost of state and local testing. We heard from the legislative auditor that they don't want to play that role, and so I do want to respect that request. I know this is Representative Kalin's provision, but I think we've already spoken with Representative Kalin, and he's fine with it. So the law amendment here quickly would be on line 18, page 19, to delete, and to find it. After the word legislature on line 18, delete the word and to the state auditor. And that's to reflect the state auditor's desire not to have to play a role in this certification of the report. Do members have that? Members, I would move that old amendment Discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair?
Members, that's the speed at which I'd like to be able to move this.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the opportunity to speed through another oral amendment if we could, so that Mike George doesn't get lost. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is page 57, line 26. This is the issue that I raised yesterday during the walkthrough regarding the time frame in which we school districts connect with parents of LEP students. And I'd simply like to delete the new language and reinstate the old so that it remains at 10 days as is current statute and practice.
Very well. Representative Dabney moves oral amendment on page 67, line 26, to strike the new language of 30 after the word within and reinsert the proposed stricken language 10. We clear, Representative?
I'm clear. Now, didn't we, I remember talking about this, and didn't we say that, like, districts are criminals now because they can't do this, and this was meant to be just a way to make them not lawbreakers, and wasn't there some language about as soon as possible without laundering them? Will be
so
that problem be resolved, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Aver, we have, I think, slightly different recollections of the department's testimony from yesterday. She's there. The 10 days is current practice. And I'll make eye contact. The 10 days is current practice. The 30 days is the federal regulation. Minnesota is and has been tighter than that. I think, you know, it's my parents' theme day. These are some of the most challenging and challenged students, and the sooner we engage the parents, the better. And this is just returning to current practice and statute.
Thank you, Father.
Members, any further discussion?
Yeah.
No, this is LEP student class special ed. This is simply going back to the tender.
Are we ready to vote?
Oh, yeah. That was something that was agreed to by the university.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
This
was language that was agreed to by the committee of the group that had met to change that back.
Mr. Chair? Representative Roden, were there representatives of LEP students on that committee?
My knowledge, no.
Unless I'm misunderstanding, thank you, Mr. Chair, unless I'm misunderstanding, I'm looking for eye contact again. This impacts LEP students. And so I think I'm not comfortable with a group of special education stakeholders making decisions for LEP students.
So, Mr. Chair, I stand corrected. Yeah. This is the department language. This was changed by the department.
He's in the balance.
Maybe I should move to a vote.
Let's vote quickly
for
the
this is supposed to be that quick
little
amendment.
No. All in favor of the Dabney amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All in favor?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Representative, we were entertaining the A5 amendment.
I think I had withdrawn it, Mr. Chair, so I would now offer the A5 amendment.
Representative Loon offers the A5 amendment, and perhaps Representative Loon, if you could just quickly, for the sake of reminding the committee members of the audience, what's your amendment?
Yes, very briefly, Mr. Chair, thank you. This amendment would delete the language section 7, referring to the basic revenue, and then also on page 10, line 28, deleting section 3. It refers to the innovation revenue and requires school districts to use 5% of their general revenue fund for that purpose. And very briefly, my concern is that we are mandating school districts to take a 5% amount of their general revenue funds right now when we don't have sufficient funds as is for, while a worthy purpose,
We've done a lot of discussions on this committee about mandate relief for our school districts, not tying their hands, a lot of discussion about really freeing them up to try to do some innovative things, Representative Benson's proposals and others. And I feel this goes in the wrong direction with regard to that prescriptive. And aside from that, I think most overwhelmingly sort of the amount that we're asking school districts to do 5% of their general revenue fund when the money isn't there right now.
Members, I would speak against the A5 amendment. I understand what Representative Luna is trying to do, and I think the sentiment is shared by some folks also here in the audience, particularly with regard to the question 7 part. We've been trying to figure out a way to deal with that issue. I did have an amendment drafted that would have postpone that out to the year 2014. It still doesn't quite deal with the issue. I thought that perhaps fixing the trigger to some kind of threshold based on when new revenues were available, that might do it, but I think we're just sort of running out of time in a hectic day to sort of come up with what kind of the right way to do this. And I understand And actually, I share some of your discomfort with Representative Loon. The intent, however, was to eventually have this match up with the Minnesota Miracle bill, which seeks to generate a substantial amount of reinvestment for people's education, so which is, for me, frankly, I was more focused on the policy language that would direct the use of those 5%. 5% dollars, and frankly, I've not given enough thought to mechanically how to figure out the trigger. It would certainly be my intent if we continue, if we're able to keep this innovation language together, to be able to address that issue. It is not my intent that we would have this immediate, impact to school districts in regard to per pupil formula appropriations. Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say, I'm sorry that it can't be amended in time. I was thinking that it was going to be, but it is definitely not for this year. It's to go into the 2015 school year, be tied in for the new Minnesota Miracle, and then it will be phased in with new revenue. It's not for current revenue. So I don't know if you want to stick on with your amendment and trust with that or not, but either way, that's what will happen.
And Representative Bradley, I would, depending on what happens with this amendment, I can certainly offer that language to put it out to 2014. It still doesn't quite do the trick, but it at least provides some comfort here as we continue to try to work out that language in municipal finance as we attempt to move forward to Minnesota Miracle.
Thanks, sir. Can I ask Representative Bradley a question?
That's after the yield, or is
he in a cognitive mood?
Representative Bradley,
I'm just puzzled in terms of process. The KFL omnibus isn't out yet. This is definitely a fiscal piece, and why wouldn't you just put everything you want of your bill there and not put it in a policy bill that has no money in any way?
Representative Abel, the issue here really has to do with a request on the part of the finance chair to the policy committee to try to flesh out some deeper language in regard to the use of the innovation fund. The current language that already exists in the Minnesota Miracle bill has been introduced on file too this year. It's good language, but it was our thought that let's provide some deeper directive in terms of use of innovation, the quote-unquote innovation fund. And so that's really the only intent, is to turn to the policy committee to do the policy work. However, we're kind of caught in that in order to make this work as a bill, it has to be able to reference that revenue stream. But we haven't quite figured out how to mechanically do that so that we can address the concern of
raises. No, I didn't realize that. I admire your ventriloquist act there, that's what I'm driving. I was just amazing. Anyway, just, but I mean, you know, the policy, in the Human Service Committee, we often hear policy stuff, and then it goes off to the Human Service Finance Committee, and then it lands in there and goes in the conference and comes out in some form. And I just don't know why this piece isn't like that. I mean, let's say we like it, but it's not quite ready for prime time. Why would you just put in your bill and let it just have a little more time to be worked on and amended as you like in your K-12 finance committee?
Senator Abler, again, we can certainly do that. Quite frankly, doing a ventriloquist act. My provision. The intent here is to respectfully request to the policy committee the state policy language. And quite frankly, as a policy chair, I would rather we do policy language here and not in K-12 finance, although, we often do that as well. But to the extent that we can do it here, I'd like to do it here. Representative Gladley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, we could have done it in finance, because this is kind of policy to go along with finance, except that it did intersect with the school report card and what group was going to approve the plans and that sort of thing. So I did ask Representative Mariani to discuss it in this committee, perfect the language. But what you described in Health and Human Services is exactly what is going to happen. This whole policy bill that we're working with tonight is going to K-12 finance, and then it will all be part of the omnibus bill. And that section that we're Representative Loon's amendment refers to is going to go into the part of the bill that's the new Minnesota miracle to be beginning to be phased in 2014, rather than the part that will be effective at the end of this year.
Oh, was it? I mean, and I'm glad. My mistake. I thought this was going on its own. So, never mind.
Representative Norton?
Mr. Chair, I just have one quick question. I may have forgotten over the last few years I've been here, but certainly it's unusual for us to be basically looking years down the road and kind of binding other legislatures to some spending in the future. That I don't recall happening very often, if ever.
Representative Norton, I think you're right, and that's why the language is the way it is inside the two amendments before us. The suggestion of 2014 is just a possible creative suggestion to get us out of the pickle that I think we're in here. And so I'm looking for a different threshold here to deal with this issue, whereas the amendment before us just simply strikes the entire issue. Members, are we ready to vote, or is it?
Mr. Chair, just before we vote, and I am committed to working with our schools and emphasizing the importance of their mission in educating every child. But I think Representative Norton raises a good point, and I feel honestly we're putting the cart before the horse by including the language that's currently in the DE2 amendment by binding school districts to a hard and fast rule. All school districts, we're assuming that the money is going to happen. We're assuming that the economy turns around and the money's all going to be there. And I just think we're placing an awful lot of faith in all of those things lining up to happen. And I just have grave concerns with all of the work that this committee has done and all of the testimony from school districts saying, please give us the flexibility to be innovative, to address our student needs, and I feel like this is kind of going in an opposite direction. So I would encourage members to think about that. I'd ask for your support for this amendment.
Members, are we ready to vote? Representative Deppe.
Representative Mariani, I have only the highest respect for both you and Representative Grayling. I have been sitting on both of these committees for the last 3 months. Both of you have been so conscious about not crossing the line for either area. I sense that this is very important to you. I think you have to make my opinion that I agree with Representative Loon, and this is a policy committee, and I think that if that's important to you to have the 2008-2009 or the earlier year in there, then I think you should do it, and then we can take care of the financial piece in the finance committee. That's my opinion, and I know that both of you have your areas, and because we're two committees, but both of you have been absolutely pure, and this now breaks the precedent. And I think that maybe you want to consider continuing what you have established with these two committees in this decision.
Members, is there any questions?
Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Representative Loon, request a roll call on the amendment. Clerk, would take a roll.
Mariani.
No.
Pat.
No.
Abler.
Yes.
Benson. Reinert.
No.
Dabney. Demmer.
Yes.
Dietrich.
No.
Zepke.
Yes.
Downey.
Yes.
Faust.
Yes.
Riley.
No.
Loon.
Yes.
McFarland. Murdoch.
Yep.
Newton.
No.
Norness.
Yes.
Norton.
No.
Overmiller. Peterson.
No.
Lawitt.
No.
Well,
no.
And Faust.
No.
On a vote of 7-11, the amendment does not prevail. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, and if you're wanting to be in the future and if it's about increase, I just have a simple oral amendment that might help you. On 1029, after the ZA, you would just insert the word increase. So it says increase basic revenue, and that can be fleshed out some more. Committee specifically, but at least that way you fix your intent across as a policy matter. If you need a delay till 2014, just say that. And on line 11, 17, if you say delete the 2009 to 2010 and insert 2014 to 2015, that pushes it out, I think, as you intended. And you can tweak dates in the finance committee. At least that, if I heard what you said, this is what I heard you say. So I'm using that.
Senator Abler moves an oral amendment on page 10, line 29, after the word "go," insert increase, and on page 11, line 17, after the word "the," delete 2009-2010, and insert 2014-2015. Are you clear, members? Yes. Senator Abler moves page 10, line 29, after the word "the," insert increase. Page 11, line 17, after the word "the," insert 2014, delete 2009. 2010 and in third 2014-2015. Since Abler, I guess technically it gets us a lot closer to the intent of the author here.
This is more buffing to come, but yeah, thank you.
Are we clear? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I don't know if this would be in order. I've got an A25 amendment that follows along the same line of discussion. I would like to offer a little different, just a little different place.
Representative Nornes, I just want to make sure we're following some kind of an order. I want to give notice to people here that want to testify, but this is on the same issue, and so I think it's appropriate for us to act. So, Representative Nornes, move the A25 amendment. If you can explain the amendment, that would be terrific.
Mr. Chair, members, overall, I believe, you know, this is going in the right direction, but I'm uncomfortable when we're mandating, again, more for the school districts to comply with. This morning I mentioned that I have a school district that's in statutory operating debt, and I checked there are actually 13 in the state that are in that situation now, and we don't know in the future how many others might be in that situation when we're again mandating this language. There's also charter schools that are in that same situation. So what my amendment really does is delete Section 7, which deals with the formula, and then the other changes simply are moving from a must to a may. So it makes it permissive, but not a mandate. And I think it leaves everything else intact and everything else basically as you want it. But again, it's not a mandate, which I think most school districts would appreciate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Members, we're clear on the amendment.
Mr. Chair,
to me, that
amendment sort of negates that intended provision of the Minnesota Miracle.
I don't disagree with that, but I don't know if that's a problem.
Well, Mr. Chair, I strongly oppose the amendment. I think most of the groups that are looking for accountability would. When I met with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, for instance, they really liked the accountability that was there. So we didn't just give school districts more and more money, same old, but didn't expect any accountability. So I'm virtually certain they would oppose this change. The Growth and Justice Group, the Parents United, the sorts of people that are the customers and the consumers of the education system would want that accountability. We had the innovation revenue was only 1% of the new money originally. And you have to keep in mind, members, this new money, when it's phased in, is $2.5 billion per year. So they have a lot of money for their other needs. This would not be imposed upon them in the straits that school districts are in. It's only when they're getting enough money to fully fund their special ed, to have the formula keep up with inflation, to have the equalization that we wish, to not have to rely on levy referendums, because some of the levy referendums have turned into state revenue instead of property tax increases. But if you're going to have that much new revenue for schools, people said, then there needs to be accountability for it. And that's what the innovation revenue is. So Representative Nornes, I suspect if you were on K-12 finance, you wouldn't, or been at any of our hearings to know what the business groups and the parents groups particularly said about this revenue. It went from 1% to 5% because of the input that we got, and there were strong feelings that it could be even higher than that, that we shouldn't just give schools money and not expect it to be tied to student learning. It's tied to value-added growth and to making sure that the students are making progress and that schools don't just get more money to do more of the same. They have to do what they're doing based on research and then turn in a plan that gets approved before they get this part of the money, so that
that it's very accountable.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to respond briefly that I think if you ask the question the way you asked it, that's the answer you're going to get. I don't think anyone would disagree with that, but we're under the assumption that there's going to be a pile of money, and I think that's where I basically have problems with this. And again, we're going to mandate money that may be there. If it isn't, of course, it's probably not a problem, but it's sort of like working with, you know, the federal government has been borrowing a lot of money. We aren't exactly borrowing, but we're kind of pledging or hoping and committing to some future funding. That seems to be way out of the realm of possibilities at this time. So, again, I just would like to have it be permissive. It can always be changed later, but right now, I really don't probably see that there's an issue because the money isn't there anyway. But to me, it's too far into the future. Again, too much speculation. We're promising something right now we can't deliver on. So I would like to see it just be a little more, less of a mandate. I don't see the problem with a may. I really don't.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, this is 5% of whatever new revenue there is. So if there isn't any, there would be none. If there's a dollar, then you'd have 5 cents and so forth. So it's not like it's taking away a lot of money if there isn't any.
Mr. Chair, to me this could be something dealt with by future legislatures once we see that we're actually in a position where we have more money.
Very well. Members, we're starting to repeat ourselves and go for it. That's usually a privilege that I reserve only to the chair.
I would also, I would also like a roll call vote, please.
Roll
call, please.
Representative Norton has called for a roll call.
Yes.
Powell?
No.
Riley?
No.
Loon?
Yes.
McFarland? Murdoch?
Yes.
Newton?
No.
Norton?
Yes.
Norton?
No.
Obermiller? Peterson?
No.
Flowers?
No.
Well?
Yes.
On a vote of 7 to 11, the motion is not today. Representative Abler, you were working on amendments a few hours ago, and I think you've got some new language for it.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the advice, and I appreciate this being put in the bill the last 2 years, and I actually think it's better now, being narrower and more focused. And I don't want to add any burdens on anybody, but I think that sometimes the benefits of a small requirement goes a long way in getting at the benefits. So, this is A2.
I'm sorry, members, I should have put that on. Wait, Representative Abler moved the A2. 19 amendment. It was originally the A2 amendment earlier.
Was it rewritten?
A19 amendment. Let's give members a second to look at it. Representative Abler, if you can just sort of refresh our memory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the A19. Yesterday, the A2, I had mine all marked up by the staff, but I'll take the cleaner version. And, Mr. Chair, this is now about purely about the arts. And it's, I don't do my whole thing. I think everybody's curious when you hear my really inspiring talk about the value of that and kids staying in school and maybe even getting some kids to put the process that would otherwise have not.
And this was promoted very heavily the last 2 years, not this year, by a bunch of art teachers who spent a good deal of time down here and persuaded me even more than I thought before about the value of how some kids stay glued to school because of their love for these various elements. Anoka has a couple magnet schools for the arts, and some kids are just thriving there that wouldn't have otherwise thrived. But anyway, but this is an elective, this is a locally developed standard, and they can do whatever they want. But the concern of the teachers was that these districts develop very nice sounding standards, and they're all happy that they have a standard, but they just, but when the push comes to shove, they just don't do it. And the only oversight in this requirement is that they have a meeting and talk about what they did. And they thought that would drive a lot of local discussion and would push the district or pull in a kind way that they would actually do what they promised. And so that's what the amendment has been redrafted to only be the arts, not social studies, and with all respect to other social studies teachers in the room who are vice chairs of important committees. But they can have their own bill in their own year, and they'll have a test sometime. And so I hope they can do that, and I'm not asking for a roll call at this point. Comment again.
Members,
I have a lot of sympathy for the arts, and I know that they're getting short changed in many of our schools as we start making the cuts. What do you think this would accomplish other than certainly within that district that might help with information, but long-term,
that would accomplish. Well, I think at the very least, it would create a level of honesty that they're what they're going to do, and so they shouldn't say they're going to have a standard and not do it. That's the concern of these art teachers, and some of them are being shuffled off to before and after school events and times in the name of, and it's not accessible, the buses don't run then, and so then the district should look at its own structure and not have an art standard, they would say. But you shouldn't have a standard and not keep it. And the sadness in that is, I mean, I'm not trying to chase him down and get him in trouble, but I want to make sure that the kids who would benefit by this would be have a chance to succeed based upon this glue that might keep them in school. Okay. Did I repeat myself?
Permissible.
Okay, I'm not prepared.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, does this require like an art show, or it says a local public meeting? What would that be?
It would be whatever meeting they wanted to convene. The school board or the school would have a meeting. It could be during a PTA thing. It could be after a school board meeting. It's very flexible on that. It's meant to be purposely not prescriptive.
And would this be at all grade levels?
Just have an order.
There's art offered.
It would be whatever they decide to do locally. It's meant to be very unburdensome and very non-prescriptive. But then I would expect that the art group would come together and talk about what they did and show some examples, and maybe get some of the parents to come look at their kids' art, and maybe it would help even, you know, some community involvement. It would be kind of fun. You could go and shake some hands. You
know? I think the school that could probably do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be a question for Representative Abler. Also, basically, this is underneath a provision that says the school board shall use standard statewide reporting procedures that the commissioner develops, and then adopt a report that includes the following. Is this to say that the commissioner should come up with some reporting procedures to show evidence of student achievement in art? And does the procedure have to include what public meeting? I guess if I was the department, I might be wondering what it is I'm supposed to be doing here to establish a statewide standard procedure.
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, my intent is clear on this. It's meant to be not a burden. It's meant to be a meeting. It could be 20 minutes. It could be 3 hours. It could be we have a studio artist crawl in Anoka, which people come to an open house. But the point is, it's clear, and it's meant to be flexible. I don't think the commission will do anything. And the evidence is presented to their own people, their own citizens at a local meeting, which is kind of like main democracy. It's the best I can tell you. I don't want to debate it. Our speeches are closed. If people like it, do it. If they don't want to do it, then don't do it.
Members, all in favor of the 819 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign?
No.
Motion does not prevail. My understanding is that there are members from members from the audience here who are present to testify on a possible amendment. And this has to do with, I believe, provisions in the having to do with non-public school. So I'm just doing a check for the audience here. I don't want to keep members here longer than you need to be. Is there anyone here who's present to testify on non-public schools in regards to special ed? All right, I have heard that there was a crew here, so I just wanted to. Why don't we see if that amendment will be offered first? My understanding is the A9 amendment. Oh, very well. Is that amendment going to be offered?
I'll offer that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dever moves the A9 amendment. Representative Dever.
Mr. Chair, if I find it in my file. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, full disclosure, this was actually Representative McFarland's amendment, and he was unable to be here, so I'm kidding. The issue we have with this particular statute, or this part of the bill, Mr. Chair, is the number of issues. I'm going to go to page 59 at the top. And actually what the amendment does is it does delete this section here. And I think this was the section that Representative Newman had his bill. On page 59 at the top, it talks about a resident school district must identify, locate, and evaluate every child with a disability from birth to age 3. Mr. Chair, that is quite a burden to lay on a school district to have to go out and find and locate all the children with a disability who are in need of special education. Does that include going door to door? Does it include, we don't know what that includes. That probably would be a practical issue.
Yeah.
So I have something different here?
Yeah.
No, we'll continue. I think you're... Yeah. Are we on the correct amendment? Is that...
Chair, I just want to mention, I believe that's federal law.
Remember, let's take this one at a time. You'll have an opportunity to respond to makers of the amendment once the makers of the amendment can speak to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just talking about the language that's been added to this bill, and... If people are telling me it's something that's already there that's needed, then why are we putting it in, Mr. Chair? But I was my quick response to that. Anyway, I think that's an issue. The next issue that I'm concerned about, Madam Chair, is or Mr. Chair, sorry. Never a different place. I'm not saying anymore. A child with a disability under 21. I think that this might be an issue in terms of age, and we're talking about an adult here, and so that could be an issue. And then, I guess in essence, Mr. Chair and members, resident school must ensure the child with disability enrolled in a non-public and school or facility. In it's on line 5, 11, 59, 11, 59, 12, and also 59, 17, and 18, the local school district must ensure for all children in non-public and other facilities that they have the opportunity to participate. I think there's a burden here for school districts that I think is just it needs vetting. It needs some work. It needs to be looked at by the department to see if this makes some sense. I just have concerns, Mr. Chair, that we're asking some of our school districts at a time when, quite frankly, they're trying to find a way to preserve what they have. I think I'm done, Mr. Chair, subject to Ms. Larson giving me some information.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah.
I think you can handle it all.
Why don't we get some responses to the internet amendment?
Mr. Chair, if I may, the intent was to clarify the federal law more than anything, and to make sure we were complying with it. And all the parties that agreed to this that were involved in the discussion. So the federal law, I think, in some cases was a little bit vague, or especially state law was a little vague as to children under three, for example, and so it was a change from birth to three.
Members, I think it is important to be reminded that, and obviously members can know how they work, but I believe all of representatives, the language is here is the result of agreements that have been hammered out by a broad group of people that involved a lengthy process of looking at social rights.
That's correct.
Mandates, and they still want to disagree with those, but I think it's important to show them.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I blurted out earlier. Didn't mean to interrupt Representative Demmer. But in another life, I did this for a living. It's part of federal funds under IDEA, and the job I had was actually working. It's a coordinated position with social services and public health, and it's federal dollars that funds it. And we were required as a partnership to go out and identify and provide services through the school district, public health, and social services. So, and I apologize for that, but that was, I can't speak to the rest of it, but I can't speak to the birth history.
Representative Abel.
Thank you, and I don't have an amendment, but as this goes along, and mine aren't doing so well tonight anyway, so I did okay in the first one. But I think as you, Representative Newton and others, I think you might be careful as you specify what was previously vague. Under three is different than saying birth to three, because now you're creating a duty to people from birth on, compared to this, as that's what you intend, but you may find yourself setting some expense and some burden where you didn't have it before. So that's just a thought as you do this. And there's so much case law on this, and I don't know any of it, but I just, and you spent a career in it in the school board being sued by people. you intended it, I think, that they're, so no, I'm just kidding. But just to be cautious as you go ahead to rewrite what doesn't have to be said may not be in your interest as you move along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is along these lines is how much of any of this is exceeding federal law? I mean, if we're just meeting federal law, then I'm fine with it. But if we're exceeding federal law in any of these paragraphs, then I'd like to know that. Because and so if anyone here can answer that question, I'd appreciate that.
We finally put some testifiers to come forward. Ms. Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Grace Keller, and I
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Gaines. I'm with the Council of School Board Association. The Commissioner's office is raising a couple of questions. So, what this provision in Section 4 was intended to do was to comply with federal law. We think that the language of the federal regulations is pretty clear on what you have to do. There's a question that the Commissioner's raised where it refers to a resident district, and this is another one of these issues that we will be looking at on Monday when we reconvene the group to go over this. But we are trying to bring this back to federal law. The requirements that the that the schools have to ensure that these kids that are served in those things get the education, and that is in federal law, whether it refers to the resident district or the school district. And the provisions on being required to spend proportional amounts is in federal law. To our understanding, the only thing that is in this section, the resident deal being tied, we'll get that clarified on Monday. But the only thing that's in here, that's my understanding, that is not consistent with federal law, is federal law only requires you to provide special ed for kids from age 3 on. In Minnesota, you have chosen to go from birth to 3 to require that, and this, I believe, just codified the decision that you have already made when they were redoing this section. That's a Minnesota decision. The rest of these things we believe are consistent with federal law. If we need to fix that one, to clarify that one issue on residents, we'll have something on that by the time the bill is heard again in the Finance Committee. But these other requirements that they apply to the kids that are in the private schools, and that are in the federal regulations.
Commissioner Friedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just what Jeff brought to my attention, too, so I really apologize. Amy Roberts, who is with our Compliance Division, actually is at a law conference in regards to many of these same issues. But she did, and Mr. Melcher also, in looking at the language, and was looking at the free and appropriate education language, there's a letter that we recently received from OSEP that was clarifying that it's not just, it's an LEA, it doesn't necessarily mean a resident district, but it's the federal office, an LEA, or LEAs are required, so it doesn't have the adjective resident, so we just want to make sure that there's some clarification on that as far as when you start to get into the finance and who's getting paid what. We want to make sure that all of that is clarified. So that is the only thing that I'm up here to. Justin will be glad to work with us on that as we try to get this tightened down as much as we can.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, the feds, when they write these things, do it a little differently than we do here. And they refer to LEAs rather than school districts. And in some cases, it may be a school district. In some cases, it may be something else. And we really don't have a real definition of how an LEA works. I know there's a bill that's around that has a definition, but it's not clear that one accurately reflects the federal law either. So it's something we'll keep working on. This, as Ms. Larson will tell you, I mean, we have spent an inordinate amount of time on this and trying to get these things to work. And of all the areas that you work in here in education, this is really very complicated. That you have the federal law itself, you've got the federal regulations, you've got the state laws, you've got the state rules, and they have to kind of go by each other and have to kind of just pound into each other like that. And what we're trying to do, and what Representative Newton has done a wonderful job of doing, is trying to get the thing, well, by the time we get to the end, that we only have one set of laws that we have to follow, so we don't end up having to litigate which sets apply. And there is litigation every once in a while in the special ed area, and it costs a lot of money. So we, you know, those aren't the types of things that we should be spending money on. Thank you.
Representative
Mr. Chair, based on what we just heard, it would seem to me that instead of including a child from birth to age 3, we should be looking at a child from 3 to 5 or some other number, some other age, at a time when they're likely to be involved with ECFE and other programs, which makes it easier to identify them. That would just be my opinion.
I do have a number of members that jumped in. I suspect we're going to start with you.
I could agree with one point that the birth certificate, I didn't know that that wasn't federal law. I know that most children have been penalized, if I'm not correct, but when it's been put in by the actor on our that were not necessarily people with disabilities as much as it could be, and we've had healthy for that. But I think, you know, it's very important that we start from birth if we're going to, especially with kids with disabilities, that we start rehabilitation or addressing their needs.
So, Mr. Chair, that means we make an appointment with the parents at the hospital as soon as the child is born?
Yeah.
Check them out?
Well,
I mean, that's an extreme, but it sounds that's what we're going to do.
Members, let's keep our discussions tight here. And by the way, we're getting interference and over the you hear that. It's usually because the BlackBerry is being used. So if you have one, please don't use it, and the preferable thing would be just to shut off your cell phone. So let's set a demo.
Mr. Chair, is my understanding this bill is going to be going into KCAL Finance next?
Assuming that it provides the vote today. that is the vote.
Well, Mr. Chair, I may have had my reasoning might not have been exactly right on. I'm, you know, not involved with this, and so I may not be the perfect person to be doing this. I do, I did hear something that is a little disturbing. It's being worked on. We'll think we'll fix it by then. It's in statute here, but I guess in light of the fact it is going to another committee, I didn't hear a lot of negativity, and I remember in committee when we heard this bill, there was a lot of credit given to Representative Newton for the work that you're doing. I just heard some again. In light of that, and in light of we got another committee to go, I'm going to pull this amendment. I'm going to withdraw my amendment.
Very well. Representative Demmer withdraws the A9 amendment. Next is the A10 amendment, because I want to make sure we get our testifiers here on this issue. Before us, they don't need to stay as long as the chair is going to wind up staying here tonight. So did someone move the A10 amendment? Is anyone moving the A10 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we're going to offer that.
All right, the A10 amendment is not going to be offered. Members, we are now on to the A6 amendment.
Never mind, Mr. Chair.
Representative Trevor, the A6 amendment. I'm sorry, Representative Demmer, the chair would rather do the 8th amendment first. These are two interrelated amendments.
Okay, that's my duty.
Very well. Representative Demmer,
it's kind of my time, Mr. Chair.
Not too much. Never moved the 8th amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the A7 amendment deals with the T20 partnership. Actually, this, Mr. Chair, would have made probably more sense to do A6 first. I'm sorry to say that. A6 passes, A7 is not necessary.
On the other hand, if A7 passes, A6 might, or A6 passes, A7 might not be.
A7 it is.
There's a glimmer of hope there.
I feel strongly both ways, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is pretty basic. In the language, it specifies people and the membership of the P20 committee. And in the House, we always have the Senate majority, or I'm sorry, the House majority leader or the Speaker appoint the majority member, and we have the House minority leader appoint the minority member. And I asked this question during committee, and I was told, well, that's not the way the Senate does it. They have the subcommittee on committees do it. And, Mr. Chair, quite frankly, I think that that effectively takes the opportunity for the minority to choose their own member on this away. We have that in the House. I believe it should be that way in the Senate. This, for me, is kind of a policy issue. I shouldn't care too much what the Senate does, but I just think if we do it that way in the House, I think it's only fair that the Senate minority leader should appoint the minority member and let the Senate majority leader appoint the majority member. And I just think that's a question of fairness, Mr. Chair. So that's my amendment.
Very well.
Mr.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have the deepest respect for my colleague, Representative Zimmer, but I don't think that I would take very kindly to the Senate dictating what the custom and usage should be in the House. And if this is how people are appointed committees there, I think that we need to let that body operate independently of our dictates over here.
Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Swales, this is not customs usage, this is law. And we always have, these laws have to come together and become a law for the state of Minnesota. And I have a senator, you have a senator, and we have as much right to say what goes into law as they do. And this is not customs usage, this is law. And I just honestly believe, as I read through this, I did ask the question in committee, I didn't offer anything at that time. But again, I think the Senate minority should have an opportunity to appoint their own member. Just like we let the House minority appoint its own member. I think that's the right thing to do. And if obviously this will probably be different in the conference committee if it gets there, and it'll either be kept or booted out, but I just felt it was the right thing to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bemmer, I actually agree with you about the Senate minority being able to appoint their own member. That's what we're doing in the House. And I would be fine if, because I'm assuming, and I should know this, but the Senate Subcommittee on Committees of the Committee of Rules and Administration, or whatever that is that minority and majority members, or just majority members? Because if it's both members, I would agree with Representative Swales. If it's just majority members, then I would agree that to leave the way it is for the majority members, but have the minority leader appoint the minority member. So that's my question. I would agree with you on the minority appointment if that committee is not bipartisan. Do you know?
Do we have any senatorial experts on the Senate here? I don't know the answer to that.
Anecdotally, my understanding is that committee is set up just like all other committees with a majority in control.
But is it?
I'm subject to correction on that, but I believe that's the way it's set up. That's
very well. So, all in favor of the A7 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All same side?
No.
Motion is not prevailed.
Have a division, Mr. Chair.
The division being called on the A7 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, raise your hand.
Four.
He's not joking, man. All opposed,
fine.
A vote of 7-10, 7 in favor, 10 opposed, the motion is not prevailed. So, Gemma, I think you have the next amendment on the TA. A6, well, the chair's plan didn't quite work here. A6. Representative Gemma, you wish to move that amendment?
Representative
Gemma moves the A6 amendment.
Again, we discussed this in committee, Mr. Chair, the P20 partnership. I like the idea of the partnership. I think they do good work. I'm just not sure that the P16 partnership is in place, Mr. Chair and members. They're doing good work. They're moving forward. They are not seeking to have it codified and have it expanded. I think they're doing good work as they're going forward. I'm not sure we need to add another layer. There's expense in this for the departments and those who have to put this together. I think they're responsible for staffing and that sort of thing. I just don't see the need to go to this year when we're in budgetary concerns as it is. It's just another layer. So that's why I believe we can stay with the P16 partnership, let them keep doing their work. We're all welcome to come to those. I've been to them. And I just don't see the need to put it into language and add members.
Very well. Discussion, members? That's so slick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I again respectfully disagree. The research that I have done and other members have done is that the most effective partnerships in the nation, and there are 30 of them, are those that have legislators who are actively involved. And I do know that we serve as a conduit to good policy, that many times great innovations are discussed at the partnership, but there is no communication with the legislature, which really is empowered to enact those innovations. And so I would encourage the members to vote against this amendment and speak the language in our omnibus bill in time.
Members, any further discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does not prevail. does anyone have the 820 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, this was an amendment that was brought to me by Representative Virgil, and I'd like to have him that week.
Representative Erdahl, welcome back to your favorite committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. After 6 years on this committee and 3 months off, it's nice to be home again. This is a bill that passed last year. It was in the omnibus bill. It was vetoed by the governor, but not because of this. So I know we have a very good omnibus bill being put together, and I just want to try to make it just a little bit better. Most of you all have already heard this before, so I'll keep this short. Refresh your memories a little bit. What I'm trying to do is a couple of things. After I took a trip to Finland, visited their schools, and a couple of areas that I'd like a task force to concentrate upon, and that is the ways to improve teacher quality and education by looking at ways in which we can increase the number of master's degree teachers that we have. Currently, one out of three of our teachers who have master's degrees are in their field of study. In Finland, for example, all master's degrees, all teachers have to have master's. They all have to have them in their field of study. Now, as a social studies teacher, if I had a master's degree in administration, that would not necessarily make me a better social studies teacher. So that's what it's about, in addition to looking at how to meld, perhaps in a better way, career strategies in vocational and academic.
Members, questions?
The fiscal note was zero on it.
I do recall that. Representative
Chair, Representative Erdahl, I'm confused by what I'm hearing versus what I'm seeing, and I may just not be understanding what I'm seeing. Is this intended to impact career and technical education? Or is this some sort of an incentive for all teachers, regardless of field, to move towards master's?
All teachers, regardless. All teachers, regardless. We have to pass for it. There's nothing being mandated here. We're trying to avoid it.
Further discussion, members?
Question I have for you, Representative Erdahl, is why in the substantive fields rather than saying like master in, for instance, I have a master of science in educational leadership, which looks at curriculum development, curriculum enhancement, and effective practice. Why are you narrowing the focus just to the substantive field of life?
Thank you, Chairman. What I'm trying to do is narrow it to the field that you are teaching. If you are, again, if you are getting a master's degree in something that, you know, may make you a better educator in other ways, that's fine. But I don't see, again, my example of getting a degree in administration is not going to make me a better social studies teacher. And I'm trying to focus on the field that we're actually teaching the students.
I like the concept of where, Mr. Chair, I like where you're going with it, but I would like to see it encompass also people that are getting a degree in a master's degree in the field of curriculum design and development that is going to help them be a better, more effective teacher.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure, if it's over.
Representative Camp, that should be part of the study. This should be, it's open to a lot of things. There are a lot of groups that are involved in it.
Well, then I guess in order to make this work, I think it needs to be amended so that on line 1.9, it would say foster classroom teachers interested or to acquire a master's degree. Because in the future substantive fields of licensure, that's where I would say that this whole task force is going to be limited to that substantive field.
But if Kath, you're suggesting a oral amendment here?
An oral amendment to say foster classroom teachers in disability to acquire a master's degree, period, and strike in the on line 1.9 and strike line 1.10.
Or suspend Bruno.
Sure.
So, Mr. Chairman, you're going to strike Representative Camp, right?
On line 1.9, it'd be foster, I'd strike in the at the end. And then on line 1.10, teacher substantive fields of licensure, keep the and. I believe I would have to keep that, just keep and a semicolon.
Representative Erdogan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Captain, how would it be different from what it is now?
From my understanding is that the task force is looking towards encouraging more people to get a master's degree, and that's what I think that would be continuing to do. But I'm correct if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think I agree with Representative Erdahl. I mean, he is looking at the model that Finland is exhibiting, and one of the reasons that they have such incredible off-the-charts achievements for their students is that these teachers are highly trained in a specific field. I'd like to think that my master's degree in writing has made me a much more effective English teacher rather than if I had a degree in, a master's just in education, which many people get. And I would contend that the logic of this particular bill is to model it after an international model that is very effective. So I think I would disagree with you, Representative.
That is fine. If that is the mission that you're looking at, a focus on the Finland model, then I would withdraw my oral amendment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Chair Representative Erdahl. I also have a master's going through. And so there's a lot of the questions. I mean, as I look at the makeup on 1.1, 1.4, to the makeup task force, there's no legislators on here, there's no teachers on here. It seems like every interest group is on here. How did you decide on this one?
Chairman, there's a flag. Pretty much everyone who expressed an interest in being in it. The idea is not to be included, but to be included.
So, no legislative expression of
interest? Mr. Chairman, no.
Mr. Chairman,
No. We try to include teacher groups, education, and so on. But no teachers.
I worry about even a task force that hasn't been well thought through. I mean, on the autism one, we have to have our research people and our parents, and then our advocate groups are one piece of it, but they're not. This is kind of every interest group that we see out here, and it seems like we could have teachers on it. We could potentially have legislators on there that. The product, if you're trying to appeal to the legislators and how you're doing it, you got thought through on it.
Again, Chairman, we did try to include as many groups as wanted in the last session. We talked to a lot of groups about this individually in my office. And again, they did go through the process last time within in the bill that just passed. And if you would have some areas that you think should be included that are not here, I'd be glad to accept that now.
Representative Norton, and then Representative Norris, and Maddie, and then Elections Debate, let's go move.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Erdahl, did you write a bill up this year and bring it through the committee and I missed it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, yes, we introduced the bill quite a while ago, and I understand you've got a very busy schedule, a lot of things going on, and Chair Mariani suggested that perhaps there would be a different way to bring this forward in light of your committee deadline and schedule.
Representative
Norton.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to suggest that it looks like the door is open here on line 1.23 of the representatives of other entities recommended. That could include people in that room.
I believe
it's
probably true.
Yes.
Representative
Daniels. Mr. Chair, the more I read this, the more confused I get. Representative Erdahl, your contention to my earlier question was that this was intended for teachers in all fields as encouragement to get their master's, and yet there's several references to career and technical education, which may be okay. I'm very interested in that issue area, but I don't see our mutual former professional association of the Minnesota Association of Social Studies teachers. I don't see the English teachers. I don't see the math teachers. I don't see a whole host of other folks. And so if it was, I don't see the Minnesota Association for Geographic Education or the equivalent there. And so it seems like this is about career and technical education, but it's not about career and technical education. And if Chair's only going to give me one bite at the apple, I would ask, if this amendment goes on, does this bill then need to go to GovOp? Because I believe all task forces have to go to the Government Operations Committee.
Academic, and it is certainly not my intent that it be heavily weighted towards technical or vocational. I'm looking at, and that's why it says academic. I also am encouraging that the academic forum be given equal. And as far as some of the groups you've mentioned, even though we're trying to be inclusive, I wasn't trying to list every group possible in this bill. But again, as Representative Norton pointed out, we have left it open for inclusion.
Members, I'd like to forget to resolve it since we have the amendment before us. With that, all in favor of the 80-20 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
If there's being called for, all in favor, please raise your hands. Keep your hands off, apparently. Where's the switch hands? All opposed, same sign. Out of all the 12 ayes and 7 noes, the motion prevails.
Excuse me, someone have the 821 amendment?
I have the 821 amendment. This also was brought to me by Representative Erdahl, and it's something that I'm somewhat familiar with, having worked with Representative Finkelstedt on school lockdown drills and replacing the number of fire drills with the lockdown drills. What this amendment does is it proposes reducing the mandates on lockdown drills from 5 to 4. But more importantly, it provides an expectation that students should be present during the drills. It's been reported that in some schools they do the lockdown drills at a time when students aren't there. And it's, we want to make sure that the students are in the room because they know how to respond.
Representative Newton moves the 821 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we'll do this more quickly. Basically, we're in contact. This is your mandate release bill, by the way, for today. Mandate release. Cut the number of lockdowns by one. We contacted all the state superintendents about the lockdown legislation, how it's been working. I would say around half of them suggested that maybe we could cut one lockdown. So that's what's in here. And also, not very many, but there are some school districts that are doing drills without students, and that was not the intent of the legislation.
Having lived through 9 fire drills a year and 5 lockdowns and drug dogs and everything else that come through the school, I guess my confusion is what is mandated. I know some of this is federal requirements. Do you know, Representative Erdahl?
Well, thank you, Chairman Quill. At one time, there were 9 fire drills.
There
don't have to be. When we negotiated this with law enforcement and with the state fire marshal a couple of years ago, the agreement was that we would drop the number of fire drills from 9 to 5 and have basically the number of lockdowns go from, well, they had to have 1, but you'd have to have students or anything, from 1 to 5, and then there's the tornado drill, so 5-5-1. Again, in consultation with superintendents, I think that it would be proper to lower it from 5 to 4, so now it's 4 lockdowns, 5 fire drills, and 1 tornado drill.
Very well. Members, are we ready to vote? All in favor of the...
Mr. Chair, justify it.
I'm sorry, please. The floor is getting late, I'm not looking around the chair. Good evening,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Goldblum, and I represent the Minnesota Association for Wheelchairs. I apologize, Charlie Kite, the executive director, is not here tonight, and I'm not seeing the amendment. So and this is not something we've actually had a conversation about, so I would prefer the opportunity to maybe have this discussion with him. But I do know one issue that has come up in past conversations in regards to the fact that students have to be present. I think there's been some discussion that school districts would like the opportunity to be able to allow the teachers and the staff to initially practice the lockdown and then practice with the students present. I'd be happy at a later time to get some more information for you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. There's absolutely nothing that says that they can't do that. The workshop, and many schools, most schools, in fact, I think, do it. They can have their training for their teachers without students in workshop time at the beginning of the school year. You know, that is not a conflict at all.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not reporting with Grace Callahan. I represent the school board's presentation. I want to echo what Kevin Gilson shared with the superintendent to use this as an opportunity to show staff where we're taking children and what the Lord them on buses. And why we do this, members, we are not focusing on human achievement. So we need some balance and we need to take some care of people forward because goodness, the house has held us harmless in education. But if we were to take cuts forward, we want to make sure that we spend those precious time together in the classroom and not carrying them up and down and needle. This is something we approach with a lot of care.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Carter. Representative Verdo, and then I think we're
Mr. Chairman, so what Ms. Schwab is saying is that they want to keep more drills. So, I mean, I'm certainly open to going back to five, but to suggest that students should not be involved in drill. I won't say what I think.
Very well. Members, we're ready to vote. All in favor of the, what is the number of this amendment? 821 amendment. Boy, it's getting late because we've seen numbers here. Aren't there? All in favor of the 821 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All same side?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Members, we have the we have the 823 amendment. Representative Demmer. Representative Demmer moves the 823 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm getting some side comments over here, so I had to deal with those, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for mercy.
They were good. Mr. Chair, if I could, I'm going to just make a couple of comments, and I'd like the department has some issues with the adaptive testing. I'm led to understand that these are not currently approved. The state of Idaho has had difficulty, in fact, lost some Title I funding when they tried to implement this. Not to say that it probably isn't good or it wouldn't go and get there, but my understanding is that all the grade level assessments are approved or something to that effect. But if we could, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like the department to come up and more clearly and concisely express their concern with this part of it. Because what this does is basically gives the gives latitude before we do these fully adaptive assessments to make sure that they're approved and something we can do.
Good evening, folks. You'll need to help us understand different parts of the amendment as well.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Michelle Weber, and I'd like to say that we have appreciated working with Representative Kalen over the last several days, and just a few minutes ago had a long conversation with him out in the hallway, and we'll continue to work with him on this. I will let Dr. Mattson walk through the specifics of the amendment to explain what we're trying to correct, both from a logistical implementation phase, as well as what we know is currently allowable under federal law, and maintains our ability to stay in compliance with what we're required to and maximize our ability to leverage as much federal funding as possible.
Very well, Dr. Mattson.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Dirk Mattson from the department. I will try and walk you through the amendment and try and address the concerns of the department.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Of the 823 amendment, it refers to page 14, line 4, and reinstating state constructive test develop. Currently, the way the language is set, this suggests, and there are other places where either developed or constructed is stricken, that this suggests that there is other places are implemented tests, and there is no test that is ready to be implemented in its current form from any contractor, from any testing vendor, from any catalog of assessment. And so it will need to be either in part or in whole developed to some degree. And so that's the language that has been inserted there. Referring to line, page 14, line 5, trying to insert, suggesting to insert for general education students, we have additional assessments that assess math and reading for students with the most significant cognitive disabilities for whom a computerized adaptive test would simply be inappropriate, and that we just want to make a clarification there that we are talking about the main assessments, not prohibiting a paper assessment or a one-on-one individualized assessment for a student with the most significant cognitive disability. Turning to page 17 in the main amendment, lines 23-24, again, our concerns of the funding aspects of being able to implement these tests appropriately and being able to maintain federal funding. And so it doesn't mean that they wouldn't be developed or we wouldn't be working on them, but until such time as the federal government allows to incorporate those in the accountability system at that time. So it's just, again, I believe, probably the thing to hear it, but clarifying when it would become a part of the accountability system. The department does have concerns regarding some of the contractual language that's identified in the bill, and that would be related to page 18, lines 21 to 24. They're struggling, I guess, with how one would give priority to contracting of something that a local district is going to buy. So a contract that I don't manage or hold or maintain in any way, but to give priority to the local district, locally funded assessment at the district. I think that's going to pose a significant challenge in trying to explain to a contractor you may receive some additional purchasing of formative assessments. I can't tell you how many, and trying to create an RFP in that fashion. Similarly, on lines, on page 19, lines 17 through 23, I believe will be very, very challenging, if not more so challenging than the area I just described. To be able to certify each year that we have the cheapest test is going to be the only way I can think to do it is that we would have to issue an RFP each year. Otherwise, I can imagine that there would be someone at this table holding up a cheapy price from the price that we have. And they would say, see, we were $500 cheaper. It was not certified on February 1. What that would mean is several things. If we have to certify each year or RFP each year, we will have to potentially could remain the incumbent, but the contract could move certainly from testing contractor to testing contractor to testing contractor. What that means for the school district is it would move from computer adaptive engine to computer adaptive engine, installing one testing program, removing it, installing another. There are other concerns as well. We would have to do all of the alignment work that is done for any particular assessment, which we have done successfully for the current test. That would have to be redone every year, and submission to the federal government would have to be redone every year that documentation has been done. So it would be a considerable cost. And again, I think the how we would identify that has the lowest infrastructure for the local district is going to change each year as well. A software that works well in my district because I have the right technology specifications for it works just fine. The following year, it may be an increased cost because I may need more hardware, software, whatever it is that was required because it was the lowest cost in the state. And finally, I guess line 23 on that same page, duplicative testing is again a challenge in trying to understand the author's intent to operationalize that term. As a local district is a math test, the state is a math test. To some degree, they are going to both be aligned to the state standards. They are going to be both measuring the state standards. In some definition, you could say that's measuring duplicative, that's measuring the same thing. So I don't know if you would, but you wouldn't call that necessarily duplicative testing. So again, a challenge to operationalize that. Finally, then, lines on page 20, line 11, the timeline. The timeline as it is in the adopted language right now requires that both reading and mathematics be implemented in the same year. This will be a significant capacity strain on the department in human capital, as well as trying to get that up and running within those years. The reading test is scheduled to be revised and implemented in 2012-13. We would be basically building a new test to last us for 2 years, and then we would have to rebuild the test, again, starting when the standards required that alignment. So there's just, I think there are some workable issues here, but certainly some logistical ones that we would like to try and clarify and would make it probably a smoother transition for both district and my staff as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Madsen. We do have the author of the bill, part of the two amendments that represent Cameron, if you can come forward and see the amendments and the testimony from the department. You can offer us your reflection on it. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Madsen, and that's good. Mr. Madsen, if you would, and I have heard you talk about this before, but could you, and I know we're on time thing here, but could you talk about the development of a test and the time frame, and as concisely as possible, the time it takes you and what you go through to do that? One of the things that jumped on me, and I appreciate you talking this through, is the time frames and the short time frames and saying we're going to do a test next year. Could you just talk about what you do and that time frame and why?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, it's not my strong suit. I will try and be concise. The test development process, any measurement, most measurement experts, I guess, will say that it takes approximately 2 years to develop a test. The items need to be developed. They run through teacher committees that verify. This happens in all states and for any large-scale assessment. They run through teacher committees that verify or at least discuss edits to the item, that it's on grade level, that it's aligned to standards. It goes to a bias committee that reviews it for bias and sensitivity concerns. The item is then field tested, so it does not count for students, but it does allow us some statistical data to see if the item performs accordingly. And this is each item, not just a test, each particular question on the test. Once that data comes back, we go through a teacher-led data review committee to see if that item performed the way we expected third graders would answer that particular question. All that work takes about 18 to 20 months. Finally, the second year at the earliest is usually, unless we are under an extreme crunch, is when that item will show up and count for students and accountability.
Very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to go back to page 19, line 1923, to eliminate duplicative testing, and I guess what I want to ask is the author. We heard Mr. Madsen's response about that particular line, but what did that mean to you when the bill was constructed?
Before you do that, I'm wondering, Mr. Madsen just went through that whole classes of how we construct or do assessments. I don't know this, so I've always wanted to ask you in the front of the room, because I have to. So who owns, where is the proprietary ownership of these products? Do we own this as a state? Does the vendor continue to own this? Who has ownership over
Mr. Chair, in Minnesota contracts for our assessment program, the state owns the proprietary ownership of that test item once it's built, and that's why we plan to use some MCA2 items on the MCA3s or whatever name, because they are our items. My colleagues from other states will tell you when they've tried to essentially rent the items, that's when it becomes challenging, because you can't take those with you into a new contract. You have to start from scratch.
Thank you. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Crowe. I think the whole framework of direction in that particular language on page 19 of which the duplicate testing is the last one, and I'm going to see if I can do this without the bill and only from the amendment.
You do have a copy of the bill here.
I'm testing myself. The aim is really to see as much as possible the diverse and dispersed different parts of the testing team, of which there are many, many layers right now. I think we have sort of development after development that has happened in a scattershot way, with some tethers being stronger and more closely connected than others. The goal is to, as much as possible, to bring them in to a cohesive, as fully aligned as possible unit of testing, so that we're not developing so that we're not developing one test that is, you know, bubble sheet or bubble pen and paper bubble test, and then performative computer adaptive, kind of the scheme that we have now. So as much as we can to get the most value non-redundant. So we don't keep representative forward particularly happy. So, but I think that's what the goal is. Dr. Matson, Ms. Weber, and I were just talking about an item actually that Representative Grimling, an approach that we, that Representative Grimling and I talked about a week ago, and that is, what I think I'm going to do is to try to sit down with the legislative auditor, with Mr. Noble, hearing the concern that Dr. Matson raised about this, that it may allow people to come to the table and have a kind of race to lower cost, having to do this annually, and the contractual question, like, very legitimate. But I'm wondering if Mr. Noble, with his long decades of experience in doing program evaluation on the complex system level, whether he might have some suggestions about ways that we could structure this certification process of this discussion that could answer that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps, I don't know, I'm just going to throw this out there, but when I read duplicative testing from a school's point of view or from a teacher's point of view who has kids pulled out of my class for all kinds, whether it's the plan, the map, the NCA, whatever, a classroom teacher would look at that and say, too much testing is going on, where if we're not looking at the science of creating the test, which, you know, that takes a PhD, like many people in our Department of Education have, and they do it beautifully. But when NWEA does the same kind of work and we have access to those tests, to me, my pea-sized brain says, duplicative testing, creating them in Minnesota and having a Minnesota product, or we have the Northwest test. And that, maybe I'm just too simple in the way I'm looking at this, but that's what that language is suggesting to me. And I think we need to be asking ourselves the questions, legislators. As I understand it, the department has around 50 people working in your department, is that correct? That's what I heard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quill, I do not have 50 employees working on tests.
Can you tell me how many you have?
I believe I have 22 professionals working on the assessment of about 49 different assessments. So I have content experts in mathematics, two of them, content experts in reading, two of them, content experts in science, two of them, a psychometrician, people who manage the project, etc. That roughly makes up that 20 to 22, depending on what.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Manson. I hope you, please don't feel defensive with me when I'm not attacking your department by any means. I'm just trying to, and you do a great job. Heaven forbid, I couldn't do what you guys do. But my point is, duplicative to me means that there are national organizations out there that provide this testing, and it's like we are reinventing the wheel. And for those of us who are in the trenches, that's what duplicative means to us. And I'm sorry that I don't have a PhD. I just have a master's degree in writing. What do I know? But, you know, that is troublesome to me.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I got to hang out with the sixth graders from North Branch today on their visit, and, you know, like we all do, we like to talk about what it means to make rules and laws, and as we do, and I explained to them the bill that I'm working on,
and I think about 90% of them, I just said, how many of you take the MCAs and remember taking them, and how many of you take the NWAs and the math? What if we could find a way to make them one test? And not only did the parents and the teachers go, wow, about 90% of the students cheered or raised their hands. And that really brought home to me this need to bring them into one test as much as we possibly can without losing the utility, without forcing them to be things that they can't be.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, and I'm not going to beat this to death, but I think we need to have a definition then of what duplicative means. Because I think we're not talking about apples to apples here. And so I would really request that we have a hard look at what we mean by that term. That is deceptive if the definition means something else than tests that are doing multiple measures of the same thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I referenced it in the committee hearing that we had on this, the differences in tools and what they're designed to be used for. Representative Swales made a comment that she couldn't design these tests, and she was deferring to the expertise that Mr. Mattson has Dr. Mattson has and his team of people. But my guess is that you've probably put together many, many, many tests and quizzes. And the reason that you've been able to do that is because you're using them to assess along the path, and I'm just going to use this as an anecdotal thing that I've heard from other instructors and teachers, because you're assessing what you've been teaching the kids, and you know what you wanted them to learn, and you want to see how they're coming, how they're doing. The tests that Dr. Mattson and the professionals in his department, in whatever words he uses to describe what those people do, have a different purpose. Their purpose is to see how the kids are doing for us to look at as policymakers, not as teachers, not as superintendents, and quite frankly, probably more as parents and policymakers and statesmen in terms of what our education system from 100,000 feet looks like and how are we doing. That's where the expertise of their department in putting these tests comes in, because they're measuring something that is not what the teachers are trying to measure in the classroom. We're trying to get a picture. To say that we can just go and get an NWEA test, and I'm going to refer back to 6 years ago, and Mr. Chair, some of the rest of you that were here, when we went through putting these standards together, we spent hours upon hours as a legislature talking about the items and the standards that were presented to us by committees of people out in the state of Minnesota for a full summer, putting together what our standards were. We were evaluating what the teachers and the superintendents and all the people in the standards committee put together with the one goal. We talked over and over and over again, we want these to be Minnesota standards. We want them to be put together by Minnesotans for Minnesota kids and designed for that. And we put our standards together and the questions and the benchmarks, and we looked at every page and probably more detail than we should. We tweaked some, but we stayed with what the committee put together. I don't know that there's any other state in the nation that has our standards at our grade levels and put together in our groupings of students. To say that we can quickly and easily grab a test from NWEA and have it fit our standards, that'll be the next thing that'll come, is we're testing things that aren't lined up with our standards. So now are we going to go another direction to redo our standards and line them up to what the tests are? It seems to me the only way we can do this and accomplish our goal as a legislature, as society in Minnesota, if you will, is to take the standards we have, we set up a pattern of reevaluating those standards every 4 years, and then let our professionals develop the assessment on the standards that we have created. That's what we're trying to do here. I remember thinking to myself, we talked about this bipartisanly when we put these standards together, put this 4-year cycle in place to review the standards, and also implemented a long-term goal of putting assessments together. Can we sustain, legislature to legislature, the temptation to tweak and change and adjust and get us off the beam? And Mr. Chair and members, I submit, here we go. We're looking at something that's over a 6-year time frame. I spoke to it earlier today when we jumped off on our testing thing. And here we are challenging whether we should be creating our own assessments or not, or buying them off the shelf, because we want to simplify it and some kids don't want to take as many tests. And that's just the way I'm seeing this, and I'm concerned that we're losing our long-term focus with what we attempted to do when these standards were established to begin with. We put revisions in place. As we revise them, we have to change our assessments. The assessments need to be done professionally. I don't know about that. Teachers do, but I don't know if it's the same thing. And you said it's not the same. And so that's my concern, and maybe I'm off base on this, but that's the concern I have with this, and I was very excited about offering the amendment. And Representative Kalin, I know you've done a lot of work. I know your heart is just in the right place. I'm just trying to put this all together and say, are we going the right direction here? Are we, as Representative Dabney, I used your quote before, Representative, is he still here? We don't need to stop at a motel. We need to keep going. And we need to move forward with the big plan and tweak it along the way, but I don't think we need to get off our plan of creating these assessments and getting off our time frame. And let's discuss the content. Let's discuss whether we do end of course, whether we do note, but let's stay on end course with our assessments and let's pull through the shot.
Thank you, Representative Bemmer. I do want to have helped to also on the refocus. I think the prefacing that has been done by both Representative Kalin and as well as the department here, that while there are some, in some cases, some big logistical issues here that are legitimate issues that we need to be carefully talked through, I don't think we've got two protagonists and antagonists that are pulling in different directions here. I think there's some creative energy in exploring what this new testing approach could produce for our state. It's a complicated stuff. It's easy to get into some kind of bigger fundamental questions, which obviously we're here to always ask. But members, I do want to just sort of set a tone here that I think both the department and the author tried to set up earlier, which is I think generally there's some pulling in the same direction, but obviously not all expect in the same track right now. Representative Reiner, then Representative
Kalin. Mr. Chair, I think you actually redirected in a really constructive manner, so I don't want to go back off track, but we could actually spend an entire hearing addressing the issue of the relationship between computer-adaptive testing and the MCAs and why we might be moving to computer-adaptive testing, whether it's NWEA or another model. I do think that Representative Kalin is going in the right direction here, and I don't think it's antithetical to the direction the department's going in. There are some tensions between the directions, but NWEA is totally capable as a testing structure of creating standards-based tests and adapting to the standards of a given state. They do that on a regular basis. When they respond to an RFP. I just don't think it's as oppositional, and I think the chair said that well, and I would just say maybe this isn't the appropriate venue for a complete vetting of the difference between the strengths and weaknesses of the MCAs and the VAs and other computer adaptive modes. And maybe there's some compromise to be reached here and we can move forward and continue the dialogue in another frame.
Remember that perhaps it's also obviously, in my mind, very creating some space once we get out of sort of the mandatory things that we need to do in this session to have some deeper discussion about some of the big fundamental questions that Representative Demmer has put on the table. Representative Kalin, if you can move along here, because the chair does want to move along here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for your interest in the subject and the debate. I want to make just one comment to this discussion, and that is just to remind folks of the comments that I made on yesterday morning about really pulling, while the map or the null, the NWAs would be my specific entry into the frustration I've really pulled back from that, and the language that's in the bill is vendor neutral, and the interest has been in actually having a state constructed and developed test, not an off-the-shelf item. And so what I'd like to do is to focus on the 823 amendment language, and I'm going to divide it into three sections in the way that I respond to it. The first will be lines 3 through 5, and then lines 6 through 12, and then the last four lines, lines 13 to 16. So again, lines 3 through 5, I think through the discussion about not wanting an off-the-shelf test, but to have a truly state-constructed, state-developed test, I support the language in Representative Demers' amendment on lines 3 through 5. Lines 6 through 12, I think I would ask the committee to oppose those sections of the amendment, recognizing that there are three items at play. One is how much we as a state can push the discussion for the reauthorization of NCLB and the use of computer adaptive tests, but the department and I have already started the round three or four of this discussion. Line 11 goes to that issue of the supplemental testing and whether we could have contractual ability to have the main test, have a vendor apply for the main test proportion as well as something that can be administered more frequently and used as a formative test. I think there are issues the Department of Administration may be able to help us with. Kent Allen, who's the guru of procurement, may guide us in some language there. And we had a long discussion about the certification issue, and I will speak with the legislative auditor about one approach that might work there. So I'd ask you to oppose lines 6 through 12. The reason why I pulled lines 13 through 16 separate is to really highlight policy questions that where I personally oppose lines 13 through 15, because I do believe that that there's enough value in pushing the development of the computer adaptive reading as well as computer adaptive math test for the 10-11 year. I asked the committee to oppose that section of the amendment, but I wanted to highlight that that I think that in Representative Riley's committee we should have a very clear discussion of the fiscal impact of the value of developing the test for those, essentially for a two-year cycle, and then when the standards will be updated for the 12-13 school year. And I think that if I can characterize please correct me not to mention, like if I mischaracterize the conversation we just had in the hallway, but I think that there may be more value that not just creating a test and having to create a whole new one in 2 years, but creating a test on challenging but doable timelines, and then having it ready for the 10-11 year, and then when the standards are updated in 12-13, having enough of the developed item for the 10-11 year be able to continue forward. I think it's a little complicated, and I think we need to continue to talk about the fiscal impact of that, and I think that may be an issue more appropriate for Representative Ryland's committee. So to summarize, Mr. Chair, I think I'd ask the committee to divide the amendment between line 5 and 6, to take line 3 through 5, and then oppose line 6 through 16, knowing that I will continue working with the department on the four issues that are raised there. And I just also want to reiterate what the department said, that it's very constructive dialogue, and I'm enjoying it a great deal, and I think I've been able to take my floaties off, and I'm starting to swim in the deep end a little bit.
Very well. Members, there's a suggestion from Kaylin to divide the 823 amendment. I'm not going to ask you to do that, but you can certainly offer that. I would ask for a member to do that. I think under the spirit of being able to adopt something as we continue to move forward, I think Representative Demer raises some important issues on lines 3 to 5. That sounds like there's agreement, and so we can continue to construct this part of the bill where there is agreement, and continue to work on the other parts. Of course, who knows, the committee might
vote to adopt the other parts as well, but you know, as we continue to build this this product together, it would be this chair's desire to see us quickly adopt those provisions that we can for the agreement.
Mr. Chair, I'd move to divide the amendment.
Senator Breiner moves to divide the 823 amendment after line 1-5. And so, Representative Breiner, if you could perhaps move for us to vote on 1.3 to 1.5 first.
Mr. Chair, I move the divided amendment lines 1.3 to 1.5.
Very well. Members, are you clear? All in favor of the lines 1.3 to 1.5, the 823 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Okay. Was that the vote on that first?
That was the vote on lines 1.3 to 1.5.
Oh, I thought that was the vote on whether we were dividing it or not.
I don't think you need to vote to divide.
No. Okay, I didn't know that. Well, in that case, I would ask for a roll call on the other two.
Very well. Representative Demmer, request a roll call on line 1.6 to 1.16.
If I could,
Representative Demmer.
Are we doing 1.6 to 1.12 now?
Yes. No, we're doing 1.6 to 1.16.
It's divided.
We divide the bill. The amendment was divided in two parts.
Oh, just in two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could just
Representative
Demmer, the only reason why I broke it up in my discussion was to highlight the timeline issue. So I do oppose session the rest of the amendment, but for discussion I wanted to sorry about the inconvenience.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, if I understand thank you. 1.6 to 1.16 is what we have left in the second half.
And that's before us at this point.
Got it. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, again, I encourage the members to look closely at the verbiage. Think about what the department had to say about being federally authorized. Think about what happened to Idaho when they lost Title I funding by doing this before it was approved. Do we want to go headlong into that now, knowing that somebody else had a problem with that? And that'd be the part in the middle where we're talking about just making sure the Federal Department of Education authorizes our state to use the fully adaptive assessments. If we don't care about the money, that's fine. This is Title I dollars. In a year where the education, the state and schools are struggling for funds. That's that section. And the very last section has to do with our schedule. We have our schedule of when we update our standards and renew and refurbish our standards and making sure that we always align assessments with the standards after they change. We're messing with that schedule in the interest of trying to be a little quicker. And I'm not sure it's a good idea to get off our schedule. So the last part is getting off from a schedule of standard revisions and then assessing the revised standards. And then I also am concerned about that middle part where we are effectively jumping into something before we know that what happened to Idaho won't happen to us. I would just have you consider that before you vote to leave that language in.
Very well. Members, further discussion?
Get a roll call. It's a roll call.
It's
a roll call.
Representative Denver called for a roll call. Roll call being called for, the clerk will take the roll.
Marianne.
No.
Yeah.
No.
English.
That's
what
you're
doing.
Benson. Steiner.
No.
Sammy.
No.
Summer.
Yes.
Yes.
Flowers.
No.
On a vote of 9 ayes and 10 no, the amendment does not prevail. Thank you, Mr. I understand you're in another committee at this point.
The last radioactive discussion on nuclear.
Very well. I'm not seeing any other amendments. I'm not begging for them either. I have a 809 old 281 amendment. Would you care to move your amendment? Or if that is your amendment.
Yes, just mine, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I was still thinking about the last vote. I'm sorry.
It's quite all right. It's been late, and I'm starting to slow down.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the 809-0281 amendment.
Very well. Mr. Dietrich moves the 809-0281 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Everyone will remember that that we had an informational, and we asked you to vote on online learning bill a couple of days ago, and as a result, what happened is when it got put in the DE2 amendment, there was some language changes made, and none of them were incorrect. Some of them just have not been vetted, though, with all the stakeholders. And when some of the stakeholders started weighing in on some of the concerns, we thought that we would try a clarifying amendment, and the clarifying amendment is the 809-0281 amendment. And the biggest difference is that it has some technical cleanup, most of it dealing with the word supplemental, which is just a good technical type change, and it supporting the definitions of online learning. And then the other thing that it does, Mr. Chairman, is that it provides a process for when an online learning experience does not meet the standards of a local school district. And those are one on the page on the amendment, it line 15 through 22. And those are the major changes, and even now this amendment could use some fine-tuning as far as some wordage, and really it doesn't change the amendment at all, but I don't want to do that until we have time to talk to some more of the stakeholders, and more specifically Superintendent Langan from International Falls. He has a real vested interest in this, and I would prefer to work with him before we make those changes.
Representative Dietrich, you and I did chat a little bit before the reconvening of the committee, and I understood that there was, in fact, a stakeholder who has been working on this, and that was my first question. And
yeah.
This language reflects discussions that you had with those individuals. And I believe you have spoken with superintendents of the school as part of that group, or that's still
yet? Not yet, and that's the step that I would prefer to take before I make any more changes to this amendment.
Very well. Members, are there any questions? If not, all in favor of the 809-0281 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We have, I'm sorry, we have an 8-3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Representative Norton.
The 8-3 amendment might look familiar to some of you. It's the fiscal education bill. It required local districts. School districts to, instead of having local standards, adopt the state or federal standards, and also set as a graduation requirement 1/2 credit. since the committee seems to be a little schizophrenic this evening about whether it wants mandates or not.
Personality.
All right. Thank you for that, Chris. I thought it might be worth bringing this forward. This particular bill would, as the testifiers said when they were here, would improve learning, it improves behavior, and we certainly know that it will improve health and supports what's happening in the healthcare committee. I did want members to know, too, it had a zero fiscal note, which we have received. And I'm very disappointed that it's not in the omnibus policy bill. I don't serve on K-12, and I am pleased to say that it does sit in K-12 finance. So I can't ever speak to the bill again, but I did want this evening for members to know that this bill is important to me. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw this amendment, but have faith in the process that it will indeed show up in K-12 finance.
Thank you, Representative Norton. So members will remember, will recall that we passed the FIAD bill, K-12 finance, about 3 weeks ago or so. It is, so clearly it's residing in the K-12 finance committee. Are there any other amendments? I'm not begging for them. I just want to make sure we're covering all the bases here. If not, then it is important to hear from anyone in the public that wishes to comment on the 1179 bill as amended. I do apologize. I know that there have been some members from the public who have been hanging around to offer testimony on different parts, perhaps, of the bill. So if you're doing that, this would be the time to come forward, and then we'll take a vote on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're waiting, that's only a comment. I want to express my appreciation to you for letting us go through these amendments and quite frankly, revetting some of the things that were in committee. I think it's very helpful and good stuff that, I mean, whether we pass the amendments or not, I guess makes a difference. It's not mine, obviously, but I appreciate the opportunity to hear them and discuss them at length, and I know it takes more time. I think it's the right thing to do. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zimmer, and let me just add that none of that is waste of time. I learn something new every time we go over, even for business that we've gone over repeatedly, and sometimes we go over pretty simple things in this committee, and sometimes we cover pretty complex issues that are interrelated with lots of other complex issues. So I think it's important for us to be able to continue to add to our knowledge base of current law, but also of emerging policy directions that we can take. So I think it's time well spent. Representative Norton, I think you have.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just for one quick moment, I wanted to update the committee members. I just talked to my wife, and she said there was a dike leaking in Fargo.
Oh.
And you have to also know that there's been a lot of students who have been chipping in here to help move it. Talked to the superintendent from Battle Lake, British Falls, all the surrounding schools. There's been busloads of students to help with that emergency. So it kind of it fits with our committee to know that, you know, we do more than just educate the kids in the classroom.
Thank you, Representative Nordis, and our thoughts and prayers are with our fellow citizens of North. We're hoping that we're not looking at the possible big damages that are being projected. You and I have served in this body together for a long time, and we can quickly recall the last time we had major flooding up north. It was quite disruptive, both to the communities that were a big blow to our state. And Minnesotans pulled together then, like we did in the south eastern part of the state a couple of years ago, and I have no doubt that we'll keep that strong, proud Minnesota tradition of pulling for one another. So I thought that with your fellow citizens this morning tonight. Good evening, Mr. Heller. I think it's Heller. What's close your name again? Because I apologize.
My name is Rick Heller.
Yes.
I can't say too well either sometimes.
Well, it is late in the evening, so Good evening. You've got some comments to offer regards to the bill.
Please stop me because it deleted a lot of stuff. I, as a parent, one of the larger school districts, a little familiar with the map and NWA, and I had a question that's kind of been outstanding for a while here about map testing being a stratified test versus the MCA is a little different. I hope I get an answer. I'll bring that back to you. As you know, my concern has been the print disability or the universal design piece as these adaptive tests get developed, as well as Mr. Newton says he's concerned as they collect this data, is it going to be valid? And then we get, like I said, in the stratified piece, right? Maybe the state can say if the NWA test is stratified, but I'm sure they are, but when the district doesn't want to answer me, concerns me because the one I see it doesn't specify it, nor... Anyhow, I had talked about, I put together a draft, now Mr. Newton will have to speak on it, about universal design. I left that with everybody at your office and copies as well. I some for the people here as well, but that's about all I have to say. I was supposed to get an answer back from State Department about their definition of print disability. I know they have a letter out, a couple of them, specifically one, I think it's September 25th, 2008. But again, I get discrepancies in the University of Minnesota. Those are developing the map and the double A map, whatever that is, for special ed. They say it's not organic, and the whole thing I was trying to get around is it's a universal design. So I know that this definition is not found in any statute as well, but I see there's another bill about the NIMAS, I forgot what it means again, that has to do with, again, basically comes down to universal design, the blind and deaf, and you know, print disability stuff in it. And I was pushing for a print disability and the 13 disabilities. Again, I'd compromise with, of course, with universal design. Somehow unified maybe in that 1600 bill, or, you know, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Newton.
Mr. Heller, I am going to ask you to move along because we do have some other members from the public that would testify as well.
And the last thing is, just so we all know, map testing does turn the testing into universal design to detect the lexile, the readability based on length of sentence and frequency of words. Again, and it's an adaptive tool, as you know. So I just thought everybody would like to know that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And then I see, I think Mr. Roberts, Mr. Null, and my good friend Mr. Field. Please come forward.
Good evening, Mr. Chair.
Good evening,
Mr. Noel, Minnesota Catholic Conference, Education Director. And our concerns with House File 1179 is the expediency with which it seems to be moving forward. And we think there's some more due consideration for some of the implications in the consequences and given some previous testimony that fiscal implications. And to wit, the combination of Section 4 and the repealer regarding 125A.18 essentially decimate special education services and are allocated for non-public school children, parental, and place who are eligible for special education instruction. The real unintended consequences that I was kind of thinking of has to do with, let's say there's about 3,000 children who are receiving special services through IDEA. If only a third of those children transfer from their school choice, their parents have decided that
venue for them as a non-public school. If only one-third of those children transfer, it seems to me, in my logic, that it would not be a net savings to the state of Minnesota as a result of that, because if children matriculate in a public school, then they still have the special education services, the full amount, plus the full state and local revenue to which they're entitled to the general education. And so that, it seems to me, there's actually an increase. We've actually increased the deficit rather than decreased the deficit. And that's something I've asked to take under advisement.
Thank you, Mr. No. Mr. Field?
Jim Field, I'm with the Minnesota Independent School Forum and the Minnesota Council for American Private Education. And I'm chair of the Nonpublic Education Council that advises the commissioner for 14 years. Basically, I was going to say what Dr. Noah said, that if the idea is to save the state money, this won't do it. And it also will kind of destroy your system. In the private school, the reason the state usually comes up with a number is about 3,000 kids that receive services. There's another 2,000 or so that don't take the services but receive the services from the school or the parents arrange it. And this will just really destroy that system. And I think the state wants to maintain this asset to the state. And private schools are not anybody's enemy. They're an asset. There's 530 schools. Every fourth school in the state is a private school. There's around 85,000 children. It saves Minnesota just under $1 billion a year. And we want to treat that as good for Minnesota. It's important if we want to really do a service with our kids and with the state. Oh, and all those parents pay taxes, too.
Thank you, Mr. Field. And just kind of to, for full disclosure, Jim Field and I go back many, many years now, and I've been working on diversity, race diversity issues and race equity issues for a good decade and a half. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Ethan Roberts. I'm the director of the Twin Cities Jewish Community Government Affairs Program at the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota, Dakota. And I'm cognizant I might actually be the person who stands between you going home, so I will. I will try to keep this brief.
I'm sure we'll try to find a way to represent to blame Representative Abler for that.
Yeah, but I'm an attorney by training, so that might be hard. At the Jewish Community Relations Council, I represent social service agencies and a handful of Jewish schools in the Twin Cities area, and I don't really come here necessarily as a representative of the school per se, but of the children and the families within the community who choose to send their kids to schools. And in terms of some of the special education, I just don't understand why we would want to put any barriers in front of these kids and their families, and why we would want to have parents make the choice between having their child receive the special education services which he or she deserves, and the choice to send their kids to a school that may not be a public school. And I don't think that was the intent. I think it's just the unfortunate consequence. And echoing some of the comments that were said earlier, I do note that in the schools which was in my community, almost all of them are K-8. And so most of these kids will end up going to public high schools. If they don't receive the special education services, K-8, that they need, I can't imagine that will be a good thing for the public high schools which they then matriculate to. So again, I just don't see how this will really end this money, and I just think it does create an unfortunate barrier that raises some equity issues. as Justin said earlier, these families certainly deserve faster than. I'm a very firm believer in the separation between church and state. I really am not coming here to try to erode that barrier, and I believe strongly personally in public schools. As my wife is a public school teacher, my father is a public school teacher, my mother-in-law is a public school teacher. But when it comes to special education, this is something that all children deserve and need. And so I really, I caution this committee. I know you've had so much going on. It's just kind of, this I think seems something that just hasn't gotten the attention, and perhaps we need to focus on it a little bit more, what the unintended consequences would be. So I thank you for your time. I know the hour is late.
Thank you, Mr. Robert. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Mr. Bartholomew. Mr. Bartholomew, Mr. Roberts is not the person who says
to know. No, I know. I'm even up there.
You're always welcome here, Mr.
Bartholomew. Thank you. I just wanted to congratulate the steering committee on putting together the power of people. Obviously, it's a lot of work and time. I wanted to thank Representative Briner for her work and the growth component. And I did just want to echo some concerns about Representative Cale's the language in the bill that looks to move our MCAs. We're concerned about losing a Minnesota standards-based assessment system for one that might be something that's a retrofitted norm-referenced assessment. I know it's a work in progress, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to work with you on that. But as President Bammer mentioned, the Minnesota educators and Minnesotans created our standards, and our tests are created by Minnesotans off of those standards. And we think that's a very important factor that we hate to see behind. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. If anyone else wishes to testify, members, any final thoughts, discussions? If not, then the chair renews his motion that House File 1179, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee of Finance with a recommendation that it be referred to the committee, the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, we're about to adjourn. I just want to let you know we are reconvening at 8:30 tomorrow morning in room 10, I am told. But here's the real kicker. After a long day in the morning tomorrow, we're apparently going to be televised. So I'm probably going to look for a couple of cats and chairs so I can hide in the corner. So room 10, 8:30.
We probably got this, but can you give me a quick idea about the agenda and length of time and all that?
Oh, boy. We have about four bills, I believe. There's five bills. Representative Newton has a totally non-controversial integration revenue bill. It should take about 5 minutes. We do have... we have the alternative teacher licensure bill that I'm offering, the Hornstein landfill, and native language passport. I might even remember that a few minutes from now. So hopefully we'll get done before the end of the morning. With that, members, this committee stands adjourned.